Hello and welcome to the PC Gamer Podcast. My name is Chris Thurston and I'm joined by Rich McCormick.
Hello.
And Tom Senior.
Hello.
Whose voice is not getting periodically higher
over time.
A commenter decided that you were going through reverse puberty or something.
I appreciated his concern, but I think he's getting me mixed up with Tom Francis or one of the other billion Toms who've worked for us and done podcasts over the past
many
few years.
Toms.
Yeah.
But I was thinking about this and I was thinking, if you were going backwards through time, like Benjamin Button.
Okay.
Or indeed, if you could simply send a message backwards through time, what would you tell your teenage self now?
Don't go through reverse puberty. It's terrible.
Fair play.
Try and seek out a scientist to freeze that reverse puberty at an optimal point. So kind of maybe 24, 25 kind of time. I know when the male prime is.
So just avoid adolescence entirely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, just skip that shit. And stick it about, you know, when you're youthful, you could do stuff, but you're not too gangly. That's really you want to move past the gangliness.
That's fair.
To sensible proportions.
So basically, it's canon now that Tom is Benjamin Button and is reverse aging.
Pretty much.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. More and more impetuous as this podcast goes on. Yeah. Slowly aging towards.
It's going to get moody and storm off to his room.
Yeah.
I would probably tell myself to F off and get my hair cut. Which is weird because that's what old men outside the pub used to yell at me when I was a teenager. So, you know, apparently they were career correct.
See,
listen to your elders.
I would buy stocks in Apple, sensibly.
Okay.
No, look, you're going forwards through time, but your body's going backwards through time. That's the Benjamin Button thing, isn't it?
Aren't we sending messages to ourselves?
Pretty much.
God.
I mean, every time we think of make a plan for the future, we're essentially sending a message to ourselves in the future, are we not?
Yeah, but that's the future. You said the past.
No, but we're going
in this saying something to yourself and then remembering it.
Yes. Yes, shut up. Shut up. It's the magic of consciousness.
It's hard to do sometimes.
It is hard to do sometimes. Yeah.
Remembering things that you've told yourself to do.
Indeed.
There you go. Existentialism.
Anyway, truisms. It is hard to sometimes think.
Sometimes thinking am hard.
Good. I thought this was going to be a nice segue into something you and I have been playing, Tom, which involves A, deep confusion, and B, travelling at various points in time.
Oh, I think I know what you're talking about.
It's a hell of a seg, if you get that right.
Oh, yeah. this is going to be a hell of a seg. Is it seg or segue? Sorry, it's a tangent.
Segue is the thing you ride around on.
No, but they're spelled differently.
We're S-E-G-U-E.
I always thought it was segue. Seg.
Seg is like...
I thought
it
was
seg.
Seg.
Segu.
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 Well, I'm going to give you a hell of a segu.
Segu
is up. This segu is going to be all the way to... Assassin's Creed 3, which admittedly we have been playing on the consoles.
Cross spit.
But to be fair, I can't really think of any way that it's going to materially change by the time it comes out on PC beyond performance things. I would still play with a pad. The things that were nonsense would still be nonsense.
A month later in the real world.
It will be a month later, but time travel is becoming a theme. We're going to travel forwards in time to when we've been playing Assassin's Creed 3 on PC for a few weeks.
Yeah.
By having played it on console.
Yes.
Tom, what do you think of Assassin's Creed 3?
I think it's a deeply confusing and slightly mental game.
Weren't they all that?
Yeah, but more so.
Yeah, more so than just like the narrative is obviously just crazy because, basically the baseline is you're trying to protect the Earth from the Sun, which is going to have a massive temper tantrum and overwhelm the Earth in about 2 weeks' time.
Why?
I don't know. It's a very complicated series of something about ancient gods who used to occupy the Earth, space wizards.
So the word space wizard is actually used in Assassin's Creed 3, the phrase space wizard.
This all happens at the end of Assassin's Creed 2, though, doesn't it? Or at least...
It all pretty much kicks off there. Yeah. I mean, like, you find this mysterious artifact. Yeah, you punch the Pope and then he tells you about... No, actually, he just gets out of the way, and then you walk through a mystical door and talk to this goddess.
And she looks at the camera as well, doesn't she?
Yeah,
they do that again later on in Revelations as well.
And you're just sitting there going, that was unexpected. But they're continuing with that. That's the meta plot which Desmond belongs to. Desmond, the incredibly boring and increasingly horse-like member of the Assassins Guild.
It's a side thing comes up from the Animus machine. Your face just gets longer and
longer. It seems to be. It's really weird. And then he's in the new engine now and he's more horse-like than ever. His face changes every
I think,
engine.
Actually, I would argue that he's less horsey than he was in Revelations. He was super equine.
Man.
And in Desmond's defense, I like him more because the character of his father, who's in this one, is a complete dickhead. Like, a complete unnecessary dickhead about everything. You walk up and talk to him.
Yeah.
Like, everyone else, you can walk in the cave, you can walk up to and press a button, and they'll say, like, oh, just an observation, I'm a character in a game. And his dad is literally like, Fuck off, Desmond.
You look like
I don't
a
like you, you tosser.
Hate you, son.
Yeah. I hate you, son.
Is that not just a really cheap method to get you to... Because obviously everyone hates Desmond and has always hated Desmond.
I think so, but it's working on me. Yeah, it's like...
yeah. I think Danny Wallace was the original.
Oh, yeah.
He was intended to be so annoying that Desmond becomes interesting. Yeah. But Desmond, like, it's such a black hole of charisma that even that failed. And instead you had a boring character and an irritated character next to each other.
But maybe to move closer to the reason, one of the reasons that game is mental. Tom, how long did it take you to finish what could be described as the tutorial?
Ooh, it's debatable, but it's definitely probably more than 6 hours.
Okay.
6 or 7 hours,
It took
maybe
me 7.5.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
What level
defining the end of the tutorial, for the sake of argument, as when the game stops introducing missions simply to teach you a mechanic.
Right.
You know what I mean? So you can't complete the mission without using the new mechanic it's teaching you.
Mm.
And B, when you are dressed as a fucking assassin in an open world doing assassin things.
Yeah.
For me, that was 7.5 hours into the game.
It's quite... How much more... I don't know if you finished it yet, but how much more is there to the game? Is it huge? Because
all
these
games are huge. It's effing huge.
It's massive,
but there's just stuff to do everywhere and not all of it. Some of it's spectacular. We were talking earlier about the sea battles.
Yeah.
Your character gets a ship, this assassin ship. It's not an assassin.
It's got
just
a ship.
It's just hiding a boat.
You stab other ships in the neck. It's
climbing sea buildings and jumping off to other boats.
Yeah. No, it's an assassin ship because it's called the Aquila, and that is Latin for eagle. And obviously, the game has a weird obsession with eagles. Just total passion for.
I think Desmond is a secret eagle.
Seagull. A seagull.
That's it. Sound more like a seagull.
Yeah,
right,
indeed. Right,
yeah.
Sorry. Okay, Tom, we can take over. Sea battles.
Sea battles are excellent. I think it's... I feel Assassin's Creed is a bit like an octopus, and it's many arms. Each arm is a different game, and most of those arms are stupid and boring.
Octopi have uniform arms.
It's like
an octopus. If one of the octopus's arms
was a pirate ship minigame.
Yeah, it was a pirate ship, and the other arm was like Farmville.
Yeah,
and then the other arm, the smallest arm of all, is actually stabbing people.
I'm going to abandon the octopus. Though. I'm going to throw that back into the sea and just.
Oh, nice, nice. I want to know which of an octopus's arms you think is stupid and boring.
I would say that you have this homestead, which is your homeland, and you can save people around the world, and they'll move to your homestead and set up businesses there. And then you get to kind of run their businesses and run convoys to New York and Boston by means of a extremely boring administration ledger minigame.
It sounds like you are describing the process and action of slavery.
They're colonists. They're colonizing new land.
But you're bringing them in.
They're not indentured.
You're capturing them, and then you bring them to your house, and you're controlling their
businesses.
You're not
capturing
them.
You're rescuing them from bandits, and you say, "Well," and they're like, "I don't want to start a new life," and you're like, "Well, there's a new life
in my house.
In my house,
come live with me in my wonderful homestead.
Yeah,
build barrels for me.
And you're not paying these people. And you're taking a cut of their profits.
Well, there's a big crafting minigame. This is so boring. I'm going to struggle not to bore people by describing it. But you buy goods off the craftsman in your homestead. So you'll buy wood off the woody people, woodsmen. And then you'll combine it to create barrels. And then you'll also combine it to create a cart that can take these barrels to New York. And then this is all done in a series of menu screens.
Yeah.
And then you'll send the barrels to New York. And an hour later, the cart will come back to your homestead and give you $200.
Isn't this a game about stabbing people?
No.
this is what it's not about.
I mean, sometimes things will happen. Like, you'll get a thing that will say, your convoy's been attacked on the way to Boston. And then if you ride out to the frontier, you can actually go and save it.
Right.
So it does kind of seem to exist in the world. It doesn't exist. You wouldn't see it going along normally. It just spawns that mission.
So it has a moment where...
But it does kind of feed into... Sort of feed into a system more broadly. But the question is, why would you do that? It's boring.
I remember in Brotherhood, it was weirdly fun to do the whole Metal Gear Solid, what's it called, Peace Walker thing, where you built up a base and then you kind of trained people and sent them off on missions on their own.
Yeah.
And you came back and you had this little ninja squad, but then you could actually affect them in real life. So you could say the ninja squad, then you went, kill that guy for me.
Yeah, you could still do that.
I like that. That was
also
nice.
Yeah, the thing with Brotherhood, it's a good example to use because Brotherhood has those kind of time sync mechanics, but they work because they actually affect the world around you and they actually change Rome. So you like part of the money sink stuff is rebuilding the aqueduct, but then when that's rebuilt, you can climb it and it leads to a secret area, I think, if you actually
complete
or
a chest or something. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. And you know, the blacksmiths you upgrade, and you upgrade them, you get better weapons from them. And also, the process of doing that is walking up to them and pressing X or something.
Yeah.
And that it just does it instantly, and you get a nice little visual change, and then you get new options, and it's all immediate. It's all like it's the world around you, and it feels like you're gradually gaining control of it. Whereas this is completely abstract. You don't like see the barrel. You can't use these barrels that you're selling. The convoys are moving through the wilderness, and that's kind of cool, but it's just an annoyance from start to finish.
Yeah.
Just a pure time sink that is desire to extend the game artificially.
It's like an MMO kind of
people, thing. People make fun of the fact that these Assassin's Creed games are such huge enterprises by Ubisoft that they have a million studios working on them all over the world. Mm. You know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people. This one does feel like every studio had a different game to make and they bolted it together. But that said, like, the kind of the history thing of Assassin's Creed, like, the production values are extraordinary. Like, it opens in the first sort of history thing you do is in the Royal Opera House. Well, what is now wasn't then the Royal Opera House in Covent Garden. Mm-hmm. And it's, like, huge crowd scene, just people watching an opera. And they've got, like, a basically what appears to be a full version of John Gay's The Beggar's Opera on stage, just happening, with actors and shit. And it's, like that. It's almost, like, ludicrously wasteful in a way, because it's, like, a tutorial mission, very linear tutorial mission. But at the same time, if you've got that interest in history and that sense of, like, I can't really think of, like, a better sort of experience of, like, exploring that.
Yeah.
Then
I can't imagine the crossovers between people who are, like, into kind of Royal Opera House stuff and Assassin's Creed games where you stab a load of people.
Yeah, I think that might be me.
Just you. You and about 10 other people.
Yeah.
Just going, oh, watching the whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I did sit there in the audience for ages. And, like, the first command in the game is, like, stand up to sneak off to the side and climb a balcony and go and kill a guy. But I just sat there, I was like, I wonder how long this is going to go on. Yeah. I was watching the opera. And they're like, hey, then what are you doing? Like, just enjoying the opera.
That's why I'm here.
Yeah.
Also, I kind of, I really like Haytham more than Connor.
Yeah.
That's the other problem.
So, okay, you play as a different character for the first 5 hours of the game. Okay. And without saying too much about it, because you don't give too much away.
Yeah.
It's a guy called Haytham who's British. And you kind of come to him later in his career than, like, the sort of novice assassins you normally play. And he's kind of flamboyant. And obviously this is all a family legacy. And he's got more of Ezio in him than Connor, who's the proper main character.
He's also an English gentleman as well. So he's kind of he's quite suave.
Yeah.
And he's incredibly authoritative with the people around him in a way that's actually quite endearing. It's the way he commands people. He's a leader because he's in a more senior position. That actually, I felt more important and it felt more, you know, empowering to play that character.
Is that the game they wanted to make?
I don't know. I mean, he plays a very specific role in the story and sort of he has a particular job to do narratively. I mean, I think it's also because partly it's just kind of, I can see what they're trying to do with Connor. Connor is like the, I guess, half Native American, half English assassin that you play as the rest of the time. And I think they wanted to differentiate him from Altair and Ezio, where Altair was super arrogant and Ezio was super flamboyant. And Connor is supposed to be just, like, really, really capable, but, like, no nonsense, like, no sort of personality, just gets the job done. No,
boring.
Sort of, but basically, it makes him boring. Like, in a way, it should, like, I think in almost any other medium, in comparison, it works. But he is just kind of like, these men have to die, but that's a shame.
Seagull's back again. Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff. Like, he grew up in the wilds, and the reason why he could run through trees and he's so dexterous is that he used to go hunting for his tribe. And, like, one of the tutorials has you hunting through the forest with him as a 16-year-old or something. And that aspect of him as this kind of wild kid is, like, beautifully reflected in the way he fights and the way he moves.
Yeah, he's been brutal.
He's just I love fighting with bare fists because he just completely mauls people. I remember doing a preview on it. He's like describing him as like a bear with a tomahawk. He goes around and breaks people's necks and he roars at them and chops them into pieces.
Yeah.
It's pretty good.
I quite like that. Yeah, again, I like that idea of narratively, like, something they do differently. Like, this is the kid who, simply by virtue of his upbringing, he's already better at this assassin stuff than everyone else.
Yeah.
But surely they could have made him into, you know, maybe slightly, if he is going to be wilder, make him more interesting character, because maybe he's
there's so much there's a nice history thing I really liked where he sort of finds out something that's happening, something bad, he's got to go assassinate a guy. Assassin's Creed, hey. There you go. He's at this sort of posh the homestead, right, this sort of manor house, and he's told this by a Native American guy that he grew up with, and the guy passes him a tomahawk and he just turns around and smashes the tomahawk into the pillar outside the house. And obviously, that's the thing about burying tomahawk in the post in the center of the village whenever you go to war,
right?
Which is something the Iroquois did. Like, it's a signal, and then at the end of the war, you take the tomahawk back out again.
Okay.
It's just a little nod to history, and it's why he does that. And everyone else is kind of shocked that he's done this really something really violent thing.
Yeah.
But it's just a nice nod to history and the culture, and, like, that's when Assassin's Creed is clever and works really well. It's like, oh, that's a nice little touch. But a lot of the time, he is just boring compared to Haytham, who. Like, there's lots of lovely sort of moments with Haytham where he's just sort of yells, sorry, as he plummets off a building.
he's brilliant. And he comes back in the story, and pretty much whenever he turns up, he's always more interesting. And I always wish I was him doing the things that he's doing. And it kind of makes more sense because he's entrenched with the British and he's come over as part of the colonials. And his whole angle on the conflict is just makes more sense than Connor's, where his original mission, which is to protect his people, has been so stretched by like 3 hours into his storyline that who knows why he's doing what he's doing really anymore.
Yeah, it's really like stabbing people with tomahawks.
Yeah, he does.
And the historical cameo thing, like the Assassin's Creed does, is just dialed up in the most ludicrous way. Like the first time you walk into a shop as Haytham, you meet a man standing outside looking distraught, and it's Ben Franklin. And like, and he's lost pages of his almanac that you have to chase over the rooftops in little parkour challenges.
Don't worry about that.
And every time you get 4 pages of Ben Franklin's almanac, you get another recipe for the homestead and stuff. Mm. And if you go back and talk to Ben Franklin, he'll just give you, he'll just tell you things that are obviously like from his writings and stuff. Like why it's better if you're going to have a mistress, make sure she's old and all this weird stuff Ben Franklin wrote because he was a dog. And
have I ever told you about electricity?
Yeah, exactly. And like, I would love to meet actually whoever does all the history writing for Assassin's Creed or whatever team does it, because they obviously have this real love for history, and there's so many in-jokes and like little nods and sort of like, I mean, I say in-jokes, but like history in-jokes, you know what I mean? And sort of like these little nods to what these characters are actually like. And it feels like they've been given this box of toys. Like, yeah, you can have Sam Adams running around making jokes about beer.
Yeah.
And like they do this little dialogue with Sam Adams where Connor says, he says like, we're fighting with the Sons of Liberty. And then Connor says a man who owns a slave. And it's a historical fact that Sam Adams was against slavery as a legislator, but was had a essentially a servant that he freed, but then stayed with him the rest of her life. And it's a sort of, and there's a little conversation about like, do you have to fully practice what you preach? And what point is it hypocrisy? And it's like, this is just on the way to a mission.
Yeah.
It's like, good for you, Assassin's Creed. But why have I only stabbed one person? This is a weird question to ask of you educational games, I guess.
Yeah. So I'm strange, okay with the killing. It's just the questions of morality that are more important.
A lot of the, I think there's just a lot of quite poorly designed missions. Really.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's so many missions that are just give you a breadcrumb trail of, floating icons that you have to hit with a horse.
That was the problem with the first one. Well, the first game was an amazing engine at the time, and well, still is really, but it was an amazing engine tied to, oh shit, what do we do in this game? Mm. Let's fill it with, I'll tell you, you're an incredible assassin, you need to do all these amazing things, but also can you find, jump across and get these floaty flag things for no real reason. And then when you come back, can you do it again, but for more of them, because we need more of them afterwards.
And that core element, the way you actually approach a target and what you actually do to get to them, just hasn't really improved enough from Brotherhood, really, or even from the first game. I mean, there's no distance between them. And a lot of the assassination missions, the explicit assassination missions in Assassin's Creed 3, are so like linear, but painfully linear. Like there's a battle on the hill. What's the famous hill?
Battle of Bunker Hill.
Of course, yeah, Battle of Bunker Hill, which of course is going to be in it because it's one of the major battles of the Revolution.
Yeah, and Connor was at all of them.
Yeah, of course. And it's absolutely spectacular. You see the British Army, all the redcoats lined up on this hill, and they're firing in rank, doing rank fire, and you have to charge the hill in cover to get around it. But if you go too far wide, you hit invisible barriers, and you have to come back into the middle and find cover, and then hop from cover to cover, and then you can't go around the right hand side; you have to go around the left hand side to where the checkpoint is, and then you have to go. Then it teleports you to the top of the hill from behind, and you can see down.
That's what really happened.
he just zipped up, and then you can see down to where the redcoats are, all like lined up behind you, with their backs turned to you. So I just charged them. I thought, yeah, I'm going to solve this war right now. I'm going to finish this. I'm going to single handedly take out the.
Yeah, you could do, because they would take it in turns as well.
They would.
There'd be 1,400. Of them just queuing,
just counter all of them and kill them.
Get tired.
And then you just run straight to an invisible wall, and then it bails you out and puts you back at the start and says, "No, you're not allowed to go that way."
Yeah.
But you can clearly see down the hill; it feels open, but it's actually incredibly constrained.
I guess they can get away with that kind of canonically because they can say, "Well, he's actually."
This is not actually happened in history.
Yeah, he's remembering a memory rather than. It's bad game.
Well, the meta stuff with the Animus is so weird. We're going to bog down in that, but yeah, you're right.
And it turns out that. Things that missionary could have been bigger if they wanted it to be, and there are a few kind of half-assed stealth routes to the target where there's this low brush that is clearly in a big line to this tree that you're supposed to climb, and then that tree leads to right over where your target is.
Yeah.
So you get a flying assassination on him. But if you don't do that, the only other option is to start a massive fight and then kill him, and that's actually how most of the missions always pan out because the stealth mechanics aren't that good, really.
Yeah.
There's no like sneak button. He's terrible at sneaking. As soon as you exit the bush, he just stands right upright, and it's like tally-ho, off we go.
Also, you're not allowed to go into a bush if the enemies are on alert.
That's right.
You will just get out again. He just jumps in, he gets out. He's like, no, there's no point.
It's cold in there. I don't like it.
So it's just, it's been really frustrating. It's just the thing I want to do in Assassin's Creed, it's not letting me do. Yeah. Instead, I'm stuck making making fucking barrels. And yeah.
This is
not, I mean,
this,
not
this is the thing, like, despite that, and we were talking about this earlier, like, it's such a tough game to kind of come to a consensus on, because ultimately there's so much there. And like stuff like the ship battling is genuinely spectacular,
yeah, cool.
And makes me want that game. Like, I want a game where you play one character on a ship, but you're captain of the ship. And when you're taking control of it, you're giving vocal commands to your crew and actually fighting naval battles in the 17th century. And that's badass. Like, I really, really want that. Like, I'm glad that's in there. It's weird that it's in this game, but fair enough. And you can ignore almost all the crafting stuff, because the amount of money you get from like sending those caravans is huge.
Yeah,
like, you know, and you get money you get from just random like finding boxes in the street is huge. And you don't really need to spend the money either, because weapons don't really make a difference when you can insta counter kill most people.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, that's all ignored. It just feels so bloated. It's annoying when those core mechanics are still so stale and they still haven't been improved upon, and when those missions are just still aren't that well designed or interesting and don't really offer you any choice.
And buggy as well.
The most fun that I had with well, the most fun with the whole series I've had has been Brotherhood, but Brotherhood's little, like, the tower, like, we had to take a tower, because that was clever. Yeah. You could pick it apart slowly, you could come at it from different kind of angles.
It's still got that with the Templar fortresses.
Which are actually better than the towers, because they're actually proper facilities, and there are a couple of ways in. And they're actually one of the better elements of the cities.
So I don't understand why they don't just make that the centrepiece. So, like, like, it was the same in 2 and in 1 a bit as well, where they just had, here's your target in this tower. It's difficult to get in, but you can get your way in, you can fight your way across the rooftops and sneak in. And then, like you say, do a flying assassination killer or get him somehow and then run away rather than just fighting everyone in a big pile.
There are still, it depends on the mission. There are definitely missions where you do have a couple of choices with how you're going to do something. And then it'll pile on the optional objectives and like the full sync bonuses, which you get for doing everything as your ancestor did it or whatever. That usually constrain you more. Like, if you want to get everything, then you'll probably do it in a very specific way. I mean, it is still possible for most of the assassinations to, if you want to do it in a really silly way, you probably still can. If you want to, you know, throw a musket at him from a mile away or something, you know what I mean? But there is still daft shit you can do. It's just, it really wants to tell you a story as it's doing that. And it really wants to kind of encourage you to do things in the way that it thinks are cool. And that's the kind of the problem. And then, when it glitches out, that's when it all kind of comes crumbling down. Like,
people said, there's a lot of, I mean, I've seen even on consoles, which is obviously tougher to get the patches out. But it, like people have said, it's got a lot of problems where people just, you know, come out of stealth or will not trigger the next animation or will not let you be able to kill them in certain ways. Or
my favorite bug I've seen a couple of times is quite a lot of times you have to tail people as having a conversation to hear overhear some information, and they've changed the mechanic for that a little bit. And it's quite possible if one of them sort of sees you that they'll go in and investigate where they last saw you. But the other guy who's having the conversation will keep walking or walk for a bit and stand still in the opposite direction. And the conversation will kind of stop and start really weirdly. As these two historical figures, like George Washington and some guy, start trying to talk to each other. But they're now looking in the opposite direction and they're either side of a building. And you're standing on the roof at this point. And they're like, yes, George, I think you might be right. But if we don't move soon, then the forces will be... And like, they can't possibly, like, how are they... It's like... And they always explain that stuff as like, the animus is broken. They're like, no, your game is broken. Like, that's
the
what
game is the animus.
You're so clever. There's a man in the I love this. There's a man in the a baddie in the modern day setting who's a Templar whose name is Cross. Hello, I'm an assassin. My name is Mr. Triangly Thing.
I'm Mr. Stab.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's Creed 3. It's weird. I mean, it's going to have all those problems on PC, isn't it, really?
Apparently it's going to be less buggy.
Everything we said is narrative and mechanics and stuff, and the chances of any of that changing meaningfully is...
It just seems like they gave themselves limited space to make it really different, and then they sold the idea, obviously, if you have Revelation and Brotherhood, and then you have Assassin's Creed 3, 2 and 3 is a bigger difference, and it was going to be different. They're going to change the engine, they were going to change mechanics, and give them a chance to break with the past. And it seems like they didn't give themselves time to do that because Revelations and Brotherhood were so recent that maybe it's different teams, but even then, you can't switch your focus entirely in that time and change everything about a game that you want to change. Yeah,
I think also, I mean, it's had such a kind of fitful development because I think on some levels, people, they really, really want Assassin's Creed to be super, super serious. And, you know, it has, you know, that kind of multicultural team of different faiths and beliefs at the start and all that sort of super serious stuff. But by the end of Revelations, which I finished last week, actually, I hadn't played it and I just played the whole thing through in about a weekend. The things that are happening are so silly that it is really hilarious. And I kind of love Ezio Auditore. I think he's probably one of the standout characters of the last couple of years.
And
his whole arc, his end, everything that happens in his story is fucking brilliant. And the last thing you do is Ezio in Revelations, which I won't spoil, is so stupid from almost from a physical and mechanical and a narrative and a historical point of view that it is actually brilliant. Like, I was trying to write down all of the different people who are involved. It basically involves, it's essentially, what you know when you're on a speedboat and you're being dragged by, and along on a parachute? What's that called?
Yeah, parasailing.
It's basically, like, historical parasailing in Turkey with like three different members of the royal family and the object of a very famous painting all in once, and like you throw men at other men while flying through the air. It makes no fucking sense, and it's wonderful.
That's
and
what you
like,
should do with
this
it,
this series
traveling.
Has become this, like, at this point someone at Ubisoft needs to put a flag in the ground and say, like, this is the low bar we have set for how daft this is.
Going back to your intro, this is what, if you could send a message back to yourself in the past, this is what you'd say. You'd say, you know, in historical past, you would say, why don't you do all this ridiculous shit?
Yeah, exactly.
I've got all of history to play with, yeah. And an incredibly flamboyant character opponent and everything. Why don't I just have a bit of fun with it rather than, yeah, I'm serious. I must avenge my family who I don't care
about.
My
village has burned down a bit again. Yeah. Exactly. But it feels like, and that's, again, maybe where Haytham stands out, because Haytham is kind of silly and there is kind of like a flamboyance to him, whereas they should have just embraced that. That's what Assassin's Creed is now. Mm. It's a po-faced man in the present, lives through the lives of his more exciting ancestors.
Wish I was dead.
Oh man, I wish I could spoil the end of Revelations, but I can't. But there's a wonderful moment for just like Ezio, you fucking badass.
Yeah.
Like, just being the funniest man in Assassin's Creed, basically.
I feel really sorry for the person in like 24 or 44 who has to live Desmond's life and
he lays down
wander
a lot
around
in bed and then...
yeah, staring out of a window, breathing on the window, thinking about tea.
What is happening to me?
he goes completely Glental in the start of Assassin's Creed 3. He does like a massive speech about how he's sick of being controlled by giant space wizards.
But he actually does use the word magic space wizards, really, which I think, again, is wonderful. It's like the writing team gets it.
Yeah, he's aware of
like, itself. Is it not that there's like three or four different personalities in the writing team pulling in different directions where someone wants it to be deadly serious and someone wants it to be silly? And
I don't know. I think there's a consensus to it, but it's sort of... I think the different ideas are fighting each other. Mm-hmm. So they have this idea that they want the conflict to be incredibly... They want you to feel like really powerful when you kill someone. You want to feel like you're doing this. You're this kind of like hand of justice that swoops down and solves things. But they also want to like highlight that assassination is actually kind of a problematic way of affecting political change.
Yeah, it's not ideal.
And so you have the classic Assassin's Creed, like, three act of an assassination, where act one is a man, like, kicking a puppy, going, I am such a twat. I am history's biggest twat. And then in panel two, a man jumps off a rooftop and kills him. And then in panel three, the man who just killed him stands over his body as he utters his last words, which are, I'm not really a twat.
I love that puppy.
I'm not really a twat. I was kicking the puppy out to help of the way of a truck. And like every single Assassin's Creed
I cured his disease with my feet.
I have magic shoes.
It's a secret puppy farm that you don't know about.
Like, and that's
and
every single him. Assassin's Creed
it
thing.
Is every single person. It's funny every time it happens. It's just they clearly know what they're trying to do.
I like it when if you kill the target in a way it really doesn't want you to do, like with a bow from miles away, and it still does the like crashed over the corpse.
Over them, yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Then
I ran really far to do
4 miles away. Like, it must be amazing to be a sniper in the modern day sniper assassin, like 4 miles away.
I was really sad because I spent a load of the hard-earned gold that I'd gotten from the barrel trade on a really suave outfit. But you know, your outfit isn't reflected visually in any of the cutscenes. So,
really?
Yeah.
Really? That's weird.
Which is crazy. I love my dark blue red trim outfit when I'm actually doing the assassination. Then I'll kill him and I'll go into the cutscene and he'll be back into his white outfit. Then he'll come out and I'm in the blue outfit. Then he'll walk forwards and he'll go to a cutscene and his white outfit again.
They put him in blue in like Brotherhood and 2. Like,
In Revelations, there's one kind of cutscene. Like, Revelations is kind of bookended by Ezio writing a letter to his sister.
Yeah.
And like in those scenes...
I'd love to stab the people.
Yeah, but he's someone like Count Dracula.
Oh, that'd be an awesome assassin.
Yeah. Actually, he was an assassin in the Vlad Tepes was totally an assassin. Yeah.
So you said to kill him, all of his villagers were his targets.
No, but there's a thing in because you know, like he fought the Ottomans, like and Revelation set in Istanbul is totally a thing about that.
One stab.
I can't, two hidden blades. Three eagles. Four mini games. Etc. Etc. What was I talking about? I distracted myself. But
Dracula.
But like they, so Count I was. But they changed his outfit in one cutscene of Revelations, and it was obviously because of a particular way of rendering it that they didn't want to do it with in-engine characters.
Yeah.
But apparently they've thrown that out completely for Revelations.
Yeah, it's kind of a mess because, you know, there's a cutscene sometimes appallingly every 30 seconds. Like, it'll throw out a cutscene and you'll walk forwards a little bit to the next checkpoint and it will immediately trigger the cutscene and you're flipping between costumes. And
yeah.
You're kind of annoyed because you
just need to get changed right out.
Yeah, it's just really annoying.
Does it still have the Uncharted work? Like, is it because in Brotherhood when you were doing the bit at the beginning where you get to your new place as... It's his old town, but you do it with Danny Wallace and that woman as well. And that was just such an obvious, like, cribbed Uncharted that, you know, they were trying to have banter back and forth and it just felt really forced and horrible.
Well, I mean, Lucy isn't in anymore, so she's not around, so there's no banter, really.
Mm.
There are Desmond missions.
Yeah.
There's a really, really weird bit at the start of the Desmond mission, the first Desmond mission, where they show that Desmond has a deployable tiny little drone camera that follows him around at approximately the height and distance that the camera is in the third person. They've gestured a few times that the Animus actually is third person, so that when Desmond is in the Animus, he's playing Assassin's Creed, right? The thing he has to do is lie down in bed and play Assassin's Creed all day to save the world.
Could be and, worse things.
And they've hinted at that a few times. Like, they've said that with the kind of the emails you get and stuff. So do they do that tiny little camera thing simply to explain why you still explore the game in the third person? Because the bits
it seems like the kind of thing that a team that large would do.
Yeah. And like, because the bits in Revelations when you're out of the Animus but still in this weird software inside the Animus, the Desmond puzzle levels are first person. And like, it's like, what? Someone is thinking about this way too hard. Yeah. And it might be me, but someone else has as well. Yeah. Like,
I want the little drone to be like a kind of a wacky sidekick. He talks.
Yeah. Hello, Desmond. Yeah. Sorry, I don't know why.
I'll call him Droney.
Yeah. Oh dear. Rich.
Hello.
What have you been playing?
Not Assassin's Creed 3. I have been playing Football Manager. Really?
Tell us about Football Manager.
I'm not sure whether you like Football Manager. Tom, you might like Football Manager.
Have it explained to me. I can ask probing questions, maybe.
Well, everyone always says it's a spreadsheet with numbers, and everyone always says it's not a spreadsheet with numbers, and it's not. It's more than just a glorified spreadsheet, but it's not really. It's a glorified spreadsheet.
That's the best back of a box quote you'll ever utter.
But it is it's not a glorified spreadsheet. It's a glorious spreadsheet.
Okay,
so
nice.
There you go. I've played
Wordplay.
Thank you. I got it when it came out, and I've been in that time. I haven't been at home much, and I haven't been able to play much, and I somehow racked up 50 hours on my save.
Jeez, is that Steam time?
That's Steam time, yeah, as well. So that's probably realistically more because I've closed Steam World.
Or less, or
just a random plucked out. But on, like, it's at least 50 hours there. I'm in sixth season now with Leicester City, who are my hometown team, and I'm in the Premiership and challenging for number one spot at the moment. But it's maintained. The thing it's done this season that's done really well, and me and Graham talked about this before, it's weird that everybody's loving it because it's got a new classic mode. And classic mode is basically the same as it used to have. It's got a lot of what it used to have. So it used to be that you, in old championship managers, before it came Football Manager, you would buy a team and you'd set a formation you liked and you'd set everybody kind of happy in training, like how much training they had to do. And then you go off and either win or lose a lot of games and you change and buy new players depending on what you wanted. So the most important things were new players and tactics. And since then they've added things like team talks were kind of vaguely important, press conferences, like proper serious stuff, like training things. You could alter every single person's training stuff. So someone who had high natural fitness could have a high training thing, and someone who had low natural fitness but was really creative could have a lower training thing, and that would change their stats over time. Classic gets rid of all that, and Classic changes it now, so you just have back to tactics and buying new players. And although you're stripping out all the technically really good features they've added, it makes it a much better game for me because I haven't got 17 hours to spend setting up my season before I start the season. I mean, Graham, trying to work out whether this means it's technically was bad game design before because there were so
removing
many things
it makes it better.
Yeah, yeah. And it's this weird thing where you're just kind of you're cutting off a whole portion of the things that were innovations previously and saying, look at it, it's new. And that's going, oh, it's brilliant because it is brilliant. Or whether that's actually means that the previous games were really bad because they're adding in new features that weren't worth doing. But then again, the new features were worth doing because people who wanted to use them did really well with them. So the training was fantastic, but it just took too long. You know, it's too complicated. And you couldn't. The big problem with Football Manager has always been, the feedback has always been that you would set someone's training regime and you have to wait 3 game months to find out if it's actually working in any respect, or whether, you know, a new tactic has failed this match because the opposition was too good, because the opposition's tactic countered your tactic, because the team hadn't had time to gel because someone was having a bad day, or whether it was just purely your team talk was bad, or whether it was because the formation you set up is bad. You need to retool that. The feedback on that is hard, and it's a lot easier now, classic mode, to come around.
How much? What I'm looking for is like, is it a sim? Like, how accurate is it to real life? Like, if you understand football really well, which I don't, but if you do and you understand how these things tend to go in real life, and you apply that knowledge, do you do better? Like, or is it about learning football managers' systems?
It is. It depends. I mean, so the match engine itself these days is better, but it's still a bit weird. So there will be times when players will in the penalty area and they need to clear the ball and get rid of it. A defender's trying to get rid of it, and he'll just run up to the ball, get ready to hoof it, and then just stop and look at it and then run away, because some subroutine in his computerized brain has told him that he's already cleared the ball, and that means then the opposition scores and you're annoyed at that fact. A lot of the time as well, someone have a shot, it'll can off the crossbar, hit your keeper in the back, and then will go in, and that becomes an own goal for you, and that wouldn't happen in real life. The guy will be ready for the ball. And there are little things like that that are very football managery, not very realistic. And there are little things as well where you will just have... So football managers always had a problem with a sense of a sensation of balancing. Like, if you're doing really well in the season and you are absolutely smashing everyone, like 20 shots a game when they're getting two or three, those two or three shots will go in from the opposition and you will have like 40 shots on target, and their keeper will get man of the match with it, like a 10.0, which is the highest score you can get in the game, like highest rating. And for some reason they'll win 2-0. Because the game's like, at least to me, it feels like the game's going, well, it's time for you to lose now. You've had too many wins.
Is that a thing that actually happens in the game, or is that you?
Because it happens so much. Like, everyone I know who's played it has had the same problem.
Okay.
I imagine it probably there may be something. I think I've always denied that exists. And maybe, you know, it does happen in real life as well, where somebody will have a very counter-attacky game and will score on the break, and those two shots will count, and all my shots will be fired into a defensive wall every time. And that can happen. And it does feel unfair, but...
Okay, yeah, it feels unfair, that's enough.
But football's unfair as well, this is the problem. Like, so much of it is, because it's so apart from other games, where it's not, is this mechanically correct? It's, we're trying to replicate the system of football. Football is repeatedly unfair and wrong and weird and goes down to bad calls and bad decisions, that you are replicating the challenge of being football manager, but you're also not doing good game mechanics, but then the good game mechanics are the fact you're a football manager, which is back round again. It's difficult to work out. But this one feels more fair in the way that when I was building my formation this time, I built a formation that structurally made sense on a football pitch. So I had a kind of a central midfield of three people, two wingers, a striker, four defenders, and then my wing backs would play up the sides, pass it to my wingers. My three midfielders were kind of a tight defensive unit that would then clear the ball out to the wings as well. And when I built that formation, that worked. And it worked in a way that you'd expect that kind of formation to work, because I watched enough football to know that it does happen in real life.
It feels like a similar issue to Assassin's Creed in some ways, where it's almost like this feature creep, this idea, I think, keeps growing and growing and growing and gets further and further away from what people actually enjoy about it. And those features in themselves aren't necessarily bad, they might be quite good, but they're just not contributing to that central reason why you'd play it.
Yeah.
And whether that's good, just because they're independently entertaining, should they be in the game? Should they be different games? Like, what would you say is the reason why you play Football Manager? What's the kick you get out of it?
Probably to win, realistically.
Okay.
That's why you play every game.
Yeah.
Why you play Football Manager?
It's basically to succeed against adversity. Like, there are a lot of people that come in and pick Man United and play Man United, whereas I picked Leicester and tried to bring them up. I mean, they had a first season because they're quite a good team, realistically. But, like, I'm not one of these players who will take Accrington Stanley and win the Champions League with them, but I do like kind of a slight underdog and pushing them up rather than picking one of the best.
What aspect of tailoring your team do you find most satisfying? Like, which
probably buying new players, like building the kind of the dream team and getting that right.
But that's that goes to the heart of fantasy football, which has always historically worked since the beginning of football.
Yeah.
So, like, the stuff that people used to do on with a pen and a paper in the pub is actually still what's really compelling about that for most people who play.
I mean, you boil it down to being. If I was a football manager, like, everyone on the weekend, if their team loses, they say, oh, I wouldn't have played him, or I wouldn't have played that. Like, a smaller amount of people will say, I would have played a different formation, and then an even smaller and smaller, and increasingly all the way down.
Different training regime.
A different team talk. You got to get these guys. So you can't say that in the press conference before guys aren't fired up enough. It's like, there's different levels of granularity. And I think that's what's great about the game. I mean, like, looking on forums to find the best players, like, you see that there are people who were very worried about classic mode and saying that it's going to change the game, because the SI is spending too much time doing classic mode, enough time doing the training stuff, which is what people love. And some people, you know, genuinely do want the game that is old Football Manager, but they tend to be the people that don't play any other games, or they have incredible amounts of time to devote to it, which is what you need if you want to be a successful. I mean, I used to play Championship Manager back in the day, and then I played Football Manager 07 a lot, and then I tried to get into 10, 11 and 12. And each one of them, I got the first season, and then it's just the second season can roll around, and I had so much stuff to do, setting up friendlies. And you can leave a certain amount of it to your system, but then it was kind of downgraded in quality as well. And now, being able to not have to do that, I've ripped through my 50 hours and six seasons in that space of time, even though I've actually taken more, I've used more of my actual real life time to play it than I did do in previous games, but it feels like I'm using less of my time. So I think this is, you know, by trimming that out, it's the best of both worlds, really. They've got Classic, which hasn't taken anything away from development, as far as I can see, where me and Graham can play our, you know, reminiscing about old teams and play that. And then they've also got in the other mode, which the reaction on the fan forums where they are hardcore has been quite good. I'm really glad that they haven't taken anything else out. The problems have been match engine-wise so far, which people are saying there are problems with. And I have seen glitches and mistakes that wouldn't actually happen that have meant that I've lost games that I shouldn't really have lost. So. And one game, so I shouldn't have won as well. So.
It's interesting because there are two different fan sets there. Sort of like an MMO at this stage where you've got your nostalgic people, like you and Graham, and you've got the super hardcore sim people.
Yeah, the PvP.
But it kind of things like Assassin's Creed 3 and to an extent from what I've played of Far Cry 3, they've just put in a load of mechanics about chopping down plants and skinning animals to make bags. And that sort of feature creep that just isn't...
It's extraneous stuff.
It's extraneous, yeah, and it's kind of diluted.
It's strange in a way. Like, there's an example with collectibles in games where, like, if you talk about Assassin's Creed 1's flags being pain in the ass to find because they're hidden on the landscape and there's no way of... If you unless you download a guide, you just sort of you search randomly for them if you get lucky. And so the answer is everyone gets a guide. And so the answer is the next game, the guide is in the game. You can buy a map that will highlight them on your mini-map. And then in 3, they're basically just on your map anyway, most of the collectibles. And it's kind of gotten to this point where what was originally intended from a mechanical point of view is find the thing and look around and explore the environment has become go to the point of the map.
Read a map. You go there.
Not even read a map. Look at the mini map. Like, follow the icon. And playing Devil's Advocate for a bit, I think that might just be, I mean, you know, that people like collecting the thing and they probably figured out that what people actually enjoyed was the moment when you pick up the flag or the eagle feather or the book or the almanac page and it goes boom.
Yeah.
And it says like, 2 of 2 collected, and like people. That's what people like. The whole kind of like the higher, you know, the more aspirational gameplay mechanical thing in there, which is like more about exploration and environments and awareness and orienteering, is actually probably from a feedback point of view, like not really worth the developer's time to kind of get right.
It's esoteric and hard to manage and hard to work out.
You know, you just give people a dot to pick up and then show them where the dot is and then they go pick up the dot. They're
it's
like,
quite
I got the dot.
It's
I'm
quite depressing
best.
Though.
I'm the best at dotting.
You could just not have those things, but then
yeah. And then the game feels thin. It's weird. It is there's a kind of, you know, as much as it'd be easy to say that like Assassin's Creed 3 would be a better game if every extraneous thing was cut out and it was just the missions in order. I mean, hopefully then the missions would be better.
Yeah.
That's the argument you could make. But... Sorry, did you just hear that really,
really
loud bar?
There's a lot of it.
I thought it was an eagle.
Maybe.
All right, one of us is about to die.
Yes, Creed 3 eagle.
I'm sure that was a sheep, not an eagle.
I thought it was a sheep as well. It sounds like it's actually in the vents.
Yeah.
It's coming from the walls,
sheep in the podcast.
That sheep is telling us to move on to the Steam charts, I think.
It's okay. The move on
that
sheep.
That was deeply...
the Steam sheep.
That was deeply strange.
It was. I'm genuinely quite worried that it's going to jump on my back and stab me with its sheep dagger.
If that happens, I'll try and...
run away very fast.
Yeah.
Suggest
you if that happens... It's just, I mean, one of us has got to survive simply to tell the story.
If that happens, can I write your obituary so I can tell everyone exactly what happened?
I think I'll let you, yeah.
Yeah, well, to be honest, we'll have time to get away while the sheep crouches over Rich's corpse.
And gnaws it.
Monologuing as Rich goes, I wasn't really a dickhead.
I didn't really.
You shouldn't have kicked that sheep on the way here.
No, that's true. Followed me up.
First mistake.
Anyway.
Back
to Football Manager very quickly
one
thing. The one thing that is still fantastic about it and the one thing that hasn't changed all the way through the series is the ability of everyone that plays the game to come up with a song about their favourite player on their team. And for some reason, for everyone I've ever spoken to who's played the game has a song that they sing.
My God, Hatfield has this.
Yeah, where you sing a song. My favourite one was...
like the least musical man on the planet.
He hates music.
Yeah, but he says he hates music.
Yeah.
I used to play in my 07 game, I had a Reading game where I played, had Leroy Leiter and Kevin Doyle up front. Leroy Leiter. Just a great song.
It's just like a little jingle for a player. Yeah.
Every time he scored. And he did it for every player.
Yeah. This is interesting because, like... I mean, you playing Dota with us last night, Rich. Mm. I play a lot of Dota. I play Dota every night now. It's gone back up again after a brief lull. And as I've mentioned many, many times on the podcast, but something that's happened between myself, Martin Gaston from Video Gamer, and Matt Lees from Official Xbox Magazine, who we play together, is we are slowly getting songs for every single Dota hero.
Yeah, it's inevitable.
Like, we have epiphanies when we figure it out. Like, you know, this is the keeper of the light. Oh, all right, that's great. Jakiro was popular. That was the first one, I think. And then recently, I was running around as Morana, whose main ability is to leap on people and throw a spear. And I threw a spear halfway across the map. Wait for it. Threw a spear halfway across the map and killed a guy. And this went, better let it have a Morana. And it was officially one of the greatest things I've ever achieved as a human being. And
does everybody else stop and just clap in their lane?
I think maybe it's a weird little human thing that when you're spending a long time in the company of like very specific names and very specific characters, like football players or Dota heroes, you do start coming up with these little songs that like, and you start singing your little song as you're running around.
Yeah, a lot of mine tend to be the same though. Zucculini, Franco Zucculini in my centre midfield. But yeah, I've always done it, and everyone I've ever spoken to has always done it as well. So it must be something that embedded in the netcode or something that just spews out like, why don't you sing? Why don't you do a little song?
Yeah, do a little song.
It's weird.
Like I quite like the thing your brain does when it's idle, like because you're not using that part, some part of your creative cortex when you're doing this sort of shit. So you just sat there like
natural songmakers. Yeah. So.
Anyway, should we do this team chart? Number 10 on the team charts is Counter-Strike Go for £12. Pretty persistent in the top 10.
Wasn't
since it came out.
Free for a weekend recently?
It did have a free weekend. That might explain the upsurge. But to be honest, it's been in the top 10 for ages anyway.
It's been a strange one. Hasn't really set the esports world alight. Like it was sort of vaguely maybe thinking about planning to, even though Valve were really non-committal on that fact. Mm. I remember interviewing them about it and saying, do you want to like step in and reignite FPS games as an esport? And they went, no, we don't really believe in like forcing our way to the center of esports and throwing money around as Dota.
Give myself the giggles about Dota. Sorry, go on.
But it's a like they did it with Dota. With Dota, they went in and went, here's £2 million that you can, or $2 million that you can have for a tournament. And then I said that to them, and they went, that's a different game. Yeah. So they didn't really kind of. It seems like they're not as committing with esports and
they put the
professional gaming.
It got they got GoTV recently, which they kind of overhauled their spectator tools and stuff, which feels like they are putting some development time into enabling that stuff. And also the free weekend coincided with the final of the Electronic Sports World Cup, I think.
Yeah,
which I'm not sure how big that is. Cause I'm not that.
No, I mean it hasn't. I follow an esports kind of fair, but it tends to be the RTS side. I mean, I haven't seen it break into the big circles, the MLGs and the IPLs and that kind of thing. But I need to. It'd be interesting to see where it goes. I mean, it's basically Counter-Strike again. I don't know enough about... I played a shit ton of 1.6, but I don't know enough about the current split between 1.6 and Source to know how people come down on which side. Apparently, from what I was talking to people before, it's closer to 1.6, but Sourcified 1.6, which is better for the competitive community, I guess. People like 1.6 more generally, but...
Well, I mean, Valve really haven't rolled the bus out for it as an esport the way they did for Dota. Like, no international equivalent or anything. No. You know, if you consider the amount of effort that went into simply establishing Dota 2 as an esport,
and even
there's massive sponsored tournaments,
to watch stuff from the main screen.
There's no doubting that that's sponsoring your favorite teams and stuff. There's no doubt that that's what it's intended to be.
Yeah.
Like if they'd wanted that for Counter Strike, it would be free to play, and it would have all this stuff built. It would basically be Dota.
And the models could be fairly similar as well, because they're aiming, obviously Dota's community is massive in Eastern Europe and Russia, and so is Counter-Strike. So they could have easily rolled out the same thing and done, you know, like you say, free-to-play, aim it at the Russian audience, have Russian servers, and
sell
like, reignite that kind of, sell hats as well.
Number nine is a game called Towns, which is £8, which is greenlit. It's like, it looks a bit like Ampere, looks a bit like Dwarf Fortress, but with you know, better interface, better graphics.
Potentially the most boring name of any game ever.
Towns.
Yeah.
Towns.
Not even cities, just, you know.
Towns.
Hamlets. Just downgrade expectations.
Hamlets is actually the James Cameron-directed sequel to Hamlet.
Oh, Chris, that's terrible, but also quite good.
Thanks.
A moment of silence.
I'm going to lunch out on that one for a little while. Okay, does anyone have anything to say about Towns?
I'm glad it got greenlit, I guess. Yeah, good. Was that not the game, though, that had terrible bugs?
I don't know. And that might be a bit unfair on these people if we're just guessing.
I'm sure it's not. It might be. There was something that was greenlit recently that was... I saw a lot of people complaining that it was released in its 0.8 version rather than its final version. And they were saying that was the reason greenlit existed, was to stop that kind of thing happening. And everyone was complaining about that. But it might not be that thing, so check it first on the internet.
Awful if true. Makes a brief return.
Yeah.
And number 8 is Tomb Raider, the new one, for £26.99.
Pre-ordering.
Yeah.
Pre-ordering, yeah.
When's it out?
Soon?
February, March. March next year, I think.
Okay.
That's an early pre-order.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who can and can't talk about it?
I can't talk about it.
Okay.
I can. I haven't seen it.
I've played it.
Oh.
I
can't actually. I haven't played it.
I've...
Can we...
Okay, ask you about it.
I don't know.
Oh, it's previewed in this
one. Okay, let's not, just in case.
Yeah. By the next issue.
Maybe.
It is in the next issue, I think.
Fine. Sorry, I'm going to cough. Give me a sec. Everyone's ready for that.
I'm ready, I'm prepared.
And now I'm not going to, because I talked about it. Okay. Right, that's how I have to. And number 7 is Natural Selection 2 for £19.
Cool.
Which I was playing this weekend.
It's really good.
Very good.
I wasn't convinced for... I had Alpha Access, because I used to play the first one a lot, mm-hmm. and I bought the old one, the new one, the Alpha thing. Had a lot of kind of problems with it going through, because it was unfocused a bit, and it's hard to get a good team. And then I played this weekend with a proper team on both sides, and really likes it. It's really slick, it's really smooth, the engine looks really nice. The only problem with it, I think, is that it's really easy to, if you're on, it's a game design problem, and it's a problem with the whole mod, the original mod and the game as a whole, and it's something I can't see a way out of. But if you are losing, you then have a long, it's a bit like Dota, but you have a long losing slide, and there's no way out of that losing slide.
It's very hard to pull back, yeah.
And that is, you know, that was in the first game, and I had a problem with that. And people still loved it because of that. Because when it is a knife edge and you could go either way, it's fantastic. It's just the case when you are a tiny skulk or something and they've got flamethrowers and stomping on your base, you just go, oh, come on, I could just log out now. And I don't see why people don't just quit at that point.
Yeah, we see people do. Or people try and change teams and stuff. Yeah, I'm really enjoying it. I was impressed to just log on to a random server and have people properly using the in-game voice chat. Coordinating properly. It was nice. It's like, I mean, everyone's speaking English, but like German guys and Polish guys and English guys.
The community's really, like, from what I've seen, it's just really nice as a loaded.
And the way it like flags new players in green, so that you literally are green, like when you start. If you say something, it says rookie next to your name.
Yeah.
And it's like, this person might not know what they're doing, don't be a dick.
Yeah.
And it's tied to how you played the game, so that makes complete sense. Like,
I think as well, especially as you're playing as the Marines, there's quite a natural inbuilt tutorial mode where someone says, build this here, and you go, well, I don't know what to do, so I'll just do that. And that helps your team, and that helps you learn what you're meant to be doing as well.
The only thing I fucked up is when I was playing as the aliens for the first time, I didn't realize that we weren't all sharing the resource pool, that it was individual. So by the end of the game, I was like, I'm going to help. I'm just going to be a skulk. I'm just going to do what everyone else is doing and follow them around and be a tiny little alien that jumps out of vents and kills people, but not try and spend all the money and not waste money.
Yeah.
But I ended up at the end of the game with like loads and loads of resources, having not used it.
On our start.
Yeah, yeah. But the guys were very, they kind of, oh, sorry, I thought this was a shared pool. And like, oh, that's fair enough. And it feels like that's something that for me has kind of been missing from games for a little while that I haven't really encountered, is genuinely friendly server communities.
Yeah.
They just want to, like, not having to go to a forum outside the game, not having to ask or find people to play with, but being able to actually learn from other players within the game is increasingly rare. I think maybe some of these games get more popular, but you never see it in Battlefield, say. Like, you never, people never go, well, what we should be doing at this point in the match is this in a game of Battlefield.
Yep.
Like, I think it's quite a good move that the developers did to make it, because it was available like in alpha and beta for a long time, and it was playable for a lot of people. If you wanted to buy it, you could play alpha from beginning of last year at least, and having that already a community who was super excited about the game because they played the first one a load. And then they're engaged already, and then you let them into the game, and then they learn every possible thing. And you listen to them as well, but they still kind of went on behind the scenes. We didn't see it, weren't kind of following it too well. And then now you get a community of people who are happy that it's out, still playing the game, obviously, because they love it and they want to keep playing it, and also want to bring people up and share the love with them.
Yeah, I want to evangelize about it. I think that's an important part of it.
Is that a sweet spot where the game is popular but not so popular that it's kind of melted?
Well, it's kind of the opposite of Dota as well, where, you know, every person on your team helps. Even they can't do something too wrong. I mean, if you die, you just die. It's not like you killing everyone else.
You know, yeah.
And the more people you have, the better off you are. So you want to bring people in who know what they're doing. You don't want to have people who might steal your kills or something like that. You just want to...
Well, like, yeah, I mean, having a bad player in your 5-man Dota game, and we frequently end up playing with like 4 people on Skype and one random, And we had one random the other day who was so bad at, I've never seen someone be that bad at Dota. I felt quite bad. He was playing Meepo, who's the guy who has millions of versions of himself. And if any of those versions die, he dies. Mm. So super difficult, super, super incredibly complex micro. And the guy was just awful. And it got to the point where we are generally jovial, but like all we could talk about on Skype is what an asshole this guy was and how much we hated him. You know, we went to bed angry after that because it was like, that makes it sound like we all sleep in one giant bed.
Move over.
Yeah, exactly. Martin said it ruined his life forever. That's one man was so bad at Dota, but like that can't happen in natural selection because if a well-mannered new guy can't really break everything for everyone else.
Yeah, and at the end of the game, you've taught him enough that he can hold his own, and then you push the wave back because you've got his machine gun in addition to yours.
And everyone understands the concept of you're a man in Alien, basically. go and shoot the aliens. Yeah, like, if you're doing that, you're helping.
I mean, the aliens are a tougher side to play as, but you learn fairly quickly, and it's not that hard.
I love the belly slide that the gorges do. I've seen that.
Yeah, they're very
little,
cute.
Little fat pig-like builder aliens can run and then jump and then slide along on their bellies. Balls get extra fast. It's adorable.
It's cute. Just when they chew your face off, it's less cute. By natural selection.
By natural selection.
Help people play it.
It is a natural selection.
Two.
It is a natural selection also.
There we go.
Number six is XCOM Enemy Unknown for £30. A game we've spoken about so much.
It's good still.
Yeah,
still
good. Remains good. Number five is Super Meat Boy, which is on sale for £2.39. I own four copies of that game. It's one of my favourite games ever.
Really?
Yeah, I love that game. It's great. I've got three on PC and one on Xbox.
Why?
I keep getting it in bundles and stuff. Okay. I bought it on PC when it came out on PC because I wanted to put it on a different platform. If you like super difficult but amazingly well designed and incredibly slick platformers, it's grand. Number four is Football Manager 2013.
I like that one. We've talked about that. Football Manager.
At number three is Hitman Absolution for £27, which again, unfortunately, we can't talk about, I don't think.
Buy the magazine. Read the review.
The mag's out, isn't it?
The mag's with subscribers have it now and will. And, right. But I think it actually will come out.
Street date then.
It's coming out. The magazine is out tomorrow.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, but we're not actually genuinely not sure. But anyway, review will be going out.
You should probably read the review.
Well, so. Read the review.
Yeah.
Read the review. Number two is Darksiders 2 for £10.20, which has been on sale, which is a good price.
About the right price.
Very, very recently.
Yeah, it's about the price I would want to pay for Darksiders 2.
You'd like to, didn't you, Tom?
I haven't played the second one yet, but okay. I probably will at that price. The first one I quite enjoyed. It's just that there's such a lack of third-person action games, proper ones, on the PC. And there's just been... Devil May Cry was on the PC, but never very good. It was always like a pretty shoddy port. And it feels like Darksiders scratches that itch.
Yeah.
And it's also... Surprisingly, it's got... quite lovely monster design, kind of world design is spectacular. And
it's really, it's really like
it's kind of
bright and pretty in a kind of a way that you wouldn't expect a game that has a main character's death.
Also, it's called death. Darksiders.
Yeah, it should be called Brightsiders.
I'm Mr. Brightside. Yeah. Well, you play as Mr. Brightside.
Mr. Brightside. Brightside.
The killers. That'd be the worst game ever. Have you noticed that this is a tangent, but I can bring this back. The new and full disclosure, wouldn't willingly listen to the killers, but their new armor's called Battleborn, which is a family from Skyrim. And I don't know if it's a genuine like a Skyrim concept.
It's a song about it.
I don't know.
I'm gonna listen to that now.
But it's a scene about mammoths and shit.
I guess so.
Actually, I'd love it if they redid themselves as
a fantasy metal band,
like Mastodon or something. But done as just mammoth. I mean, Brandon Flowers up front with his long swinging hair, headbanging.
He doesn't. Look a thing like a Dovahkiin.
Go on then, Chris. You said you could pull this back.
That was my entire tangent, and it's back. But I mean, the pulling it back was getting it to Skyrim from the killers.
Okay, that's all
right. Right, I'm going to give both of you one guess. What's at number one on the Steam charts? The guess you share.
Something to do with.
I don't know. What?
Doody.
That's that game that's come out.
Balls of Doody. Did you just say Balls of Doody on the...
it's very mature of me, wasn't it?
Christ, we're bringing out fucking A-game today.
Is it the Blops 2?
It is.
The Blopples.
It is Captain Blopper's future adventure.
Mr. Blop himself.
Surprised there's no entry for Dishonored at all on that chart.
Yeah, that is surprising. I guess everyone who wants it bought it now. I mean...
It was quite low actually down the chart originally.
It came in, it got to like 2 and 3 I think for a while. Yeah, it is interesting. Especially because XCOM is still doing well.
So,
Number one is, if I'm getting this wrong, let me know, Call of Duty Black Ops 2.
I've never heard of it. don't know what it's about.
I'm going to play it. I've got to look forward to playing it. Yeah, I always play.
I talked you down from buying it straight away.
I almost bought it just out of sheer
madness.
Woo!
Yeah,
thing is out. I'm gonna buy
it's
it.
It's like
there's
a point where you can be really skeptical and informed about marketing and kind of like what hype is and why people make such a big deal out of launch dates and all this stuff that's nonsense and that you should always wait and see what the critical consensus is before you buy a game.
You should
wink, smite, glowy, teethy thing. Moving on. But in this case, it's funny. Like a certain amount of hype can override your better judgment completely.
Yeah, I think the thing is, I always buy Call of Duty straight away because it's so big, it's so huge. I feel like I have to play it in order to.
Yeah, you feel a little like part of something.
Yeah, well, it's not
it's
so much
a bad thing.
Also, just as a duty, as someone who watches the industry and covers the industry.
Do you feel the call of duty?
I feel the call.
It's a very different
to
call
to
be on in the game, though.
And I like shooters as well. Actually, there aren't that many shooters that are released every year, you know, and it's always at least solid. From a shooter perspective,
it seems to be doing. I mean, so our review's not done yet because we've got Martin on it at home at the moment, and he like the thing that Call of Duty was reprehensible about was the thing that Medal of Honor's taken on now about the whole it's real war,
real
and
soldiers,
yeah,
like hanging out helicopters, throat. Authentic tier one operations.
Whereas this one now is
growing beards.
It's a silly action movie.
Shooting
it's an
beards.
80s action movie, and it's an action movie in the
those men have got beards. We've got beards. It's war.
It's beardier. It's an action movie that is an 80s action movie, which is ridiculous and over the top and Verhoeven-ness.
That's where they need to go. Yeah. Like, that's what Black
and that's okay, because like. It's fine to go that end of silliness. Like, if you're going to have a ridiculous corridor shooter that has stupid firing round corner guns and motion sensors, then
how can you fire around a corner in a corridor, Rich? That doesn't make any
it's
sense.
A turny roundy corridor. It goes around
bendy
corner.
Oh no, the turny roundy corridor.
You guys are stuck like this.
That's it now, yeah.
Gentlemen.
End the podcast.
I love
Bendy
it.
Bendy corridor.
Isn't the bad guy?
Sounds like a Metal Gear Solid subtitle.
A beard with a man attached who is a celebrity who then turns evil and steals the key to the America's drone warfare.
Maybe.
Suite.
I thought this time they made him to be like a kind of a like a crazy
he's
wild
like,
kid rather than.
I thought isn't he like
hacker kid?
Isn't he like Julian Assange, but also Osama bin Laden?
Assange bin Laden himself. Gotta kill Assange bin Laden.
Potentially live listening. So.
Yeah. bleeping that shit out.
Waka waka.
I thought it was like some kind of like hacking wunderkind that could hack everything and did that for fun. Because this, the our campaign's been a lot more lighthearted as well. Like it's not been so America's under attack.
I think
I'm in the voice now as well.
America. In a world where there is America. America
that's
is
this world,
attack.
Chris. We're in that world.
Call of Duty.
Is it about tomorrow's better tomorrow?
Yeah. Tomorrow.
Tomorrow's war. By the presenters of Tomorrow's World.
It's got
didn't
drones.
Quite go as we expected it to.
It's got wingsuits. There's a bit where you jump out of a plane in wingsuits. And it's got these are things I want to do in games sometimes.
Yeah.
And I just want to see how they make it happen.
Like, yeah, it's the same as Assassin's Creed thing. Basically go silly with stuff.
Yeah.
I'm wary of being enamored of a shooter because of a bit where you fall out of a thing since Battlefield 3, where the only good bits in that single player campaign were you in some kind of air vehicle or falling from the sky.
Every shooter that has that in is good though. Like not the whole shooter is good, but that section in every shooter is a good bit. Like Crysis, best bit is dropping out of the plane. Really,
yeah, yeah.
Does Crysis 2 have you drop out of the plane?
No,
that's where it went wrong. Really,
yeah. If you push it out of the plane at the beginning, it'd be brilliant.
Yeah,
like of other games that I've played, there are lovely bits where you drop.
Terrorists have fixed America to a giant lift. It's moving into the ground.
Jump off and again.
And the multiplayer tends to be okay and. Yeah, basically, it's just such a big thing. I feel like we should play it and just see what it's all about.
Yeah, I mean,
not going to send us copies.
It seems that it's not as hateful as it could be. And it's weird. People seem to be almost warming to it now. Like the commenters have always on our site have always been so. You must hate Call of Duty, and if you don't, you're wrong. And then you see the Metacritic ratings for user.
We
ratings.
Do have a question about that coming up.
There you go. Yeah. But like the Metacritic ratings are always 0, 1, 0, 0. This game is shit because I
best selling game
hate
ever, pretty much.
And I'm going to hate this. Whereas it's you know if you're going to hate stuff,
it's the same thing as anything else. It's internet vulnerability to popular opinion, which is often set by. You know, a consensus that, you know, this is the game we hate, this is the game we like. And when anyone goes against that, reviewers or just commenters, there tends to be a backlash from people who only show up to make that one comment and then vanish again forever.
I mean, there are massive.
It's easy to misread, is what I'm saying.
There are massive problems with the model. I mean, you can't do it forever, and eventually, you know, empires crumble, and you can't have that coming out every year. Because
empires crumble.
There's
Activision have to make a different game. Call of Duty 5.
It's been out. It's like 7, nine, ten.
Call of
Modern Warfare 3 looked pretty rusty, really. I mean, on PC,
they need a new engine, I would argue.
It looked pretty shoddy. Yeah. And they need the time to I mean, the next gen Switch is going to be a big deal for them.
Yeah.
So like, you kind of look forward to the future down the tunnel of time, and Call of Duty is always
or just
there.
Time.
It's kind of yeah.
You look forward into the future.
I look forward and
you predict. Anticipate.
And in every year, it seems inevitable that there'll be another one because people don't seem to be getting tired of them.
Mm.
But there are a couple of faltering points, and the next gen Switch is going to be one of those where if they don't make that transition, then it could actually affect them.
Yeah. Kind of like media events now as well. They're not just games anymore. Like the amount of cross promotion that happens is ridiculous.
Led into the mainstream.
Product placement and all this sort of, you know, this sort of stuff that surrounds it. I can't really think of. They're like Bond movies.
We got sent. Graham got sent three emails, each of which had like a 10 megabyte attachment that was just pictures of celebrities at the launch event playing Modern Warfare, playing Black Ops, like just playing. What do we do with that? What are we meant to do? Here are some people
like,
that play the
film
game.
Critics don't have to deal with this shit. Like, look, it's a man watching a film at a premiere.
I don't know if they do.
Maybe they do. Man who is in film watches his own film.
I didn't like it. I didn't like my performance. But it's a straight, like you say, it's a media thing now. And fortunately, it seems that this one at least is better than. I mean,
the reviews have been.
I've played every one. I have a thing where I have to play them all three on veteran because I played two and three on veteran because I was bored. And then I have to do everything now because I've tested myself. And Black Ops 1 was by far the worst of all of them so far, including World at War.
Wow.
And World at War. Wow.
Yeah.
I haven't played World at War, but I heard it was pretty dreadful.
It was bad, but that was at the very tail end of shit.
World at War.
Wow.
Not wow.
Tom sort of went, wow.
Wow.
Not whoa.
Whoa. Just mimicking noises.
It was okay, but they were really like, we need to get something out of World War II, and then and then thing came along. Because that was their reaction to Modern Warfare 1, and it was. Into dev politics, I think, more than anything else.
I would.
But the multiplayer in World of War was actually surprisingly good because it had tanks in it, and everybody hated that, but I like tanks.
Awesome.
So.
Good. I've never actually played a Call of Duty game.
Really? Not one?
Never.
Play COD 4.
Yeah, I was thinking, I've got it as well. I own it, and I just never played it. Like, it's my biggest blind spot.
You've never seen Star Wars. Yeah.
They're not long.
I've never seen Titanic. That's the only like major cultural thing that I've never seen.
You don't need to see
it. Yeah, no. When I was a kid, I had a falling out with my best friend because he thought Titanic was a better film than The Full Monty and contended that there must be something wrong with me. He contended there was supposed to be something wrong with me because at the age of 10, could identify that The Full Monty was a better movie.
That's like making a bear and a platypus fight. They're just different. They exist
and
for
making,
different
styles. But I think it's a strip as well.
Anyway, that's tangent I cannot link back to PC games.
We've got a full Monty of Steam charts that we've just talked about, and now onto the
Twitter questions. Actually, okay, the first Twitter question is going to inform the rest of the Twitter questions we've got.
Hang on a minute. Oh, I should have done that at the start of the team charts.
Oh, God, you changed everything.
It's the sheep. The sheep got to me. It's put me off my game.
Yeah, the fucking seagull and the sheep. And
oh, man.
Confusing animals.
I'm still doing this on a beach.
Chris Atkinson asks, which one of you can balance your mobile phone on your head for the longest?
This is obviously a challenge that's intended to get us to place our phones on our heads for the duration of the podcast. But we could easily pretend to do this and then not actually do it. I have said that.
I think we have a contract an obligation to honesty and forthrightness. I think we should answer the rest of these Twitter questions with our phones on our heads. And it's harder for me because I'll keep looking at the fucking list.
Okay. It's a challenge.
Rich is going to have to win this.
You could potentially win. Exactly. So.
I don't have my phone with me, but I've got my iPod.
Yeah, that's acceptable. I've got mine's an iPhone, so it's going all right. My iPhone is now, and this is I'm going to put it. I'm going to put the full disclosure. I'm putting the Mac side of my iPhone case on hair downwards because it is more. This is awful.
This is strangely formal.
If anything, this is a good way of keeping us sustaining our fucking microphone.
I think this is easy, and I'm going to win.
Tom Dare asks, I can't even read.
No, this is surprisingly difficult.
How do you think Guild Wars 2 can solve the problem of low player numbers in low-level maps? Assuming this is a problem, I haven't actually been in low-level maps myself, which might be it.
I was in the Halloween event recently, the low-level areas weren't that deserted, I don't think. I think the solution is just new events to draw people back into that.
I mean, you know, the fact that you're scaled down to the area you're in. I can't not
be animated very hard
when I'm talking. It's really weird. The fact that you're scaled down to the area you're in means that there's no reason they can't just drop new stuff into those areas and incentivize people to go back and explore them. Basically, this stuff just has to be cool enough to drag people away from Lion's Arch.
I remember
it's a weird problem that for me, my problem with originally was the fact that
if you win this, it's because you've got a massive head.
Yeah, I know. My problem originally was the fact that there were too many people. So I was just getting dog piles. Talking's really hard because it's bouncing around the top of my head. I was getting dog piles with people and it didn't really have an effect on people. Now the opposite's happening. Alex Wiltshire on Edge has been playing it recently. And he says there's just no one there. So he's got the same problem. I think it is, like Tom, like both of you are saying, that you need more people. You need more events and these things to get more people back in.
Yeah.
But that involves developing more stuff, and that is difficult to do. So I think it's I think it's a hard problem.
I mean, they're doing a very good job of adding new content pretty regularly, like the new stuff is going up this weekend.
Can you not just smush servers together and bring people together in areas?
Well, that kind of already is what happens with the overflow. They just need kind of reverse overflow. They need underflow.
Reverse that flow, man. The Halloween event, like, they opened up, there was a load of stuff outside of Lion's Arch where there were these haunted doors that appeared in sectors around Lion's Arch, go through them into the Mad King's kingdom, and kill glow-in-the-dark skeletons and stuff. But they were appearing in, like, Gundaran Fields, which is, like, quite a mid-level zone. And they could have just had staged those in the low-level zones, and that could have reversed that a little bit, but only for the duration of that weekend, really. So that's the trouble with those areas.
Yeah.
Stephen Buckley asks, will the new planet side have the same player base as the original? I think it's almost certainly going to do better, based on the fact it's free and no subscription and the hype that's been building around it for the last week.
Yeah, I'm nodding very tentatively because of the... I don't want to lose this thing, but I agree. I'm going to agree audibly. I agree.
I think a lot of people will still play the original as well because they made that free. It's interesting to see how much the devs are listening in PlanetSide. Like, I kind of follow the development fairly closely, and a lot of things are being changed based on what the community says, which is interesting and also potentially worrying if they get it wrong, because you'd hope game designers are game designers and the community members aren't necessarily game designers. And if people are making changes that then immediately get rolled back because someone said... So the problem is at the moment, things like recoil and like weapon balance and that kind of thing.
Yep.
If someone says this gun feels wrong because they've used that gun and they like that gun, and then they go, okay, we'll change it back, what, you know, is that good? Is that the right thing to do? Blizzard's approach has always been, they look at the numbers behind it. And, you know, having spoke to Matt Higby, this is really hard to keep talking this in my head. Having spoken to Matt before, Matt Higby, he said, you know, they look at the numbers as well. So hopefully they are, but it does seem that a lot of the changes they're making...
I mean, I think there are pretty tangible problems, especially with the new player experience still. I think it's a thoroughly confusing game, especially the bigger base sieges. I was playing it this weekend and just, like, I'm still finding it tough to crack. And I've no doubt that there's a game to be discovered there, or at least I hope there is. But the fact is, and this maybe doesn't speak to player numbers, but it certainly will speak to the bounce rate of people trying it and bouncing off it, is that at the moment, like, I have no clue what's going on, or how I capture these bases. And I know I can ask people and look on the forums and stuff, but really, it shouldn't be as unintuitive as it is. And it feels like it's complicated simply because it needs to accommodate so many people.
It's an immeasurably better game when you play it with people, which is probably more than any other game I've ever played, apart from something like Dota. And even then, you can play it fine on your own. Like, if you're not playing with people on PlanetSide, you do just... Unless you're going for, like, a purely Mosquito run or something like that, then you do feel lonely and, like you say, bored and listless and a bit pointless.
Well, it's and that's the danger, because that's why people will naturally try it.
Yeah,
and that's something they've got to address. They can't just simply say, well, it's fine if you team up with your mates, because
they need to get the social stuff locked in. I mean, last time I played it, the outfits and stuff were being weird and weren't working. You couldn't invite anyone unless they were online, and they would just drop out of your outfit occasionally. I mean, they are fixing it at an incredible rate and fast enough that, having followed it really closely, the complaints aren't now about the things that they were about before. They are about minuscule things. I don't know whether that's just people warming to it, or whether that's because people have already bounced off, or whether that's just because actually...
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I did bounce off it as originally, as you know, and like, going back this weekend, better in some ways, but I'm still... I just feel like you have to... Like, there's very little meaningful downtime in that game, and meaningful downtime is what... Like, you know, waiting for a galaxy and stuff doesn't happen as much. And that's what actually causes people to talk and stop and make friends and things. Yeah. And that's... If you don't have a, like... You know, as we were saying with natural selection, I miss the days when you didn't have to bring a friendship group with you from outside the game in order to make friends in the game.
Yeah, it feels like...
And I worry that maybe that'll be the case with PlanetSide.
It feels people have done really well are the groups that have come over from PlanetSide 1, and also the groups that have come in from other games. So a lot of Battlefield players are coming over and playing it. They're coming in as full companies and just setting up as outfits and just doing well.
Hopefully hopefully it'll be sorted out for launch, but we'll find out.
For me, it's the most exciting game in the world.
Yeah, I know, but, you know...
But that's like, if they manage to get that enticing finger wink, and they bring in a community that is...
I beg your pardon?
Finger wink. A wink and a beckoning finger.
A finger wink.
A wink and a beckoning finger.
Finger wink.
I don't...
I just do not want to go anywhere near that phrase.
Come near my finger ring.
No. No.
Okay.
No, Rich. Fine. And move, but I've got a phone on my head.
Okay. What about that?
Okay. Peter Hardy asks, I've sunk 3,500 hours into Team Fortress 2, but nothing else draws me in as much shit.
Oh, he's gone.
First one down. Man down.
Nothing else draws me in as much shit.
Sorry, Peter. I'll get back to your question in a minute. Yeah, so I'm out first. But to be fair, I am trying to hold up and read a sheet of Twitter questions.
Oh, here can make excuses.
Yeah, and I don't have a massive head like Rich, or pointy, I imagine, grippy hair like
quite,
Tom.
Quite spiky hair.
Also,
today.
Tom has gelled it, and also, I think he's tied it round his head with his...
No, his headphone cable is around his phone, that's... which is going to add extra traction.
Extra torque.
Yeah, they're made of rubber, actually, as
but,
well.
But, Rich, so, yeah. You know, that a certain amount of travel is necessary simply for it to get off the large flat part of the top of your head.
the top part's quite pointy, but it does go a long way, so...
Mm.
Don't think too hard, otherwise it'll kind of slide off.
Anyway, so Chris Atkinson, I can certainly not balance my phone on my head the longest. But that's because I've got a normal sized head and cool hair. Anyway,
what's the question?
Peter Hardy says, I've sunk 3,500 hours into Team Fortress 2, but nothing else draws me in as much. What game makes you just keep coming back for more? And I love this. I don't usually say people's Twitter handles as well, but his Twitter handle is ILoveHats12, which may go some way to explaining the fact that he spent 3,500 hours playing Team Fortress 2.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's worrying is that there's another 11 I Love Hats out there.
Yeah, indeed. Well, yeah, I mean, perhaps.
Maybe they love different hats.
Maybe he just loves 12 hats.
Real hats, maybe, yeah. Hats times 12. Hats to the power of 12.
I think there will always be games that I go back to constantly. Dota, I talk about endlessly, but that's because it is just the game I play when I'm done with thinking about games too much.
We've talked about this before, the idea of downtime games, where I will go into a game like Dishonored, and I will start off a session by playing a game of Dota, and I'll bookend the session by playing Dota. I had a long period of that with StarCraft. I've dipped off that a little bit, because Heart of the Swarm's come in, and I want to wait for that to come out before I go back to proper multiplayer. And Tribes Ascend actually was one as well. Match Tribes Ascend in between stuff, and then I go back to other things.
A little bit of Guild Wars for me, actually. I've been playing a little bit more on and off recently. I still haven't hit level 80, but... it's sort of, you know, it just sort of fills time in a way that feels fun and meaningful.
It's a warm up or a warm down. It's like you know.
It has to be. It's an interesting combination. It has to be a game that is easy enough to get into and occupies a kind of compartmentalized amount of time, so that I don't have to dedicate my evening to it.
Yeah,
but it also has to be mechanically deep enough that I still find it interesting. Like, I still find Dota interesting after all this time, and I still, you know, still things to discover in Guild Wars.
We talked about like the idea of downtime and you kind of you're filling space, bookending stuff. It's like you say, like when I play Dota, I'm not actually thinking. And I play StarCraft as well. Like you're talking and you're thinking and you're analyzing and you're strategizing, but you're not thinking. You're not going, oh, I need to go shopping this week, or should I go and do this? I need to take the bins out. You are just going, I need to.
You're occupied, aren't you?
Yeah, I need to not die. I need to jump out this lane. I need to build up a force of Marines. I need to do this now. This is my next task. It's like a very rapid to-do list sorted out, and it's something that helps your brain unwind, or you know, get more stress, but in a constructive
different way.
Way, maybe.
I like it used to be Call of Duty for a bit. I used to, because that's very compartmentalized. You just jump in for 5 minutes, or you can stick around and level up a bit. Then it was Gun Game in Battlefield 3 when Close Quarters came out, and also Diablo 3 every now and then, because you could run one. Balls.
I can run balls.
Yeah, that's right.
And
so by the favorite
Chris Atkinson, the answer to your question is Rich McCormick can balance his mobile phone on his head the longest. He's now removing his phone.
Always win everything.
That unfortunately the podcast takes away a certain element of the competition. That happened then because Tom,
I was vibrating.
Like, I noticed your head was moving quite a long way. You were traveling.
I felt it sliding, so I was compensating.
Yeah.
But then I think, I don't know, a spasm of some sort came over me and threw it off.
Like, we did move around quite a lot as we recorded the podcast, and that has brought that to an end. Thank God. You were saying, sorry about the Call of Duty.
Yeah, Diablo 3, because every world run is about 40 minutes or something, and it's a solid arc, and you always get something for doing it. And I could also I could stick the knees on and play Diablo 3, but absorb both at the same time. I do that a lot, actually, where I'll be playing something on one screen. I've got two screens on the monitor, watch something that isn't taxing, that doesn't require precise attention on the other screen. It's just a way of filling my brain with chaff.
Yeah,
I don't know what it is.
I cannot watch something play a game at the same time.
I think I'm now turning into like a dog when you go on holiday and you have to leave the TV on because it gets lonely on its own. Like if I'm upstairs where my PC is, I will put the TV on at the same time, no matter what it is. So like playing heavily now, like Dishonored, playing heavily narrative based games, and yeah. I halfway through the like a speech, so I get annoyed at the TV and put it on mute, not turn it off, just put it on mute, and I like still having the light bright colours in the corner of my eye,
around,
so yeah. I'm not lonely upstairs, really.
Oh man,
that's weird. I think this we could analyse the psychology of this quite heavily.
But it is interesting. Like, I've started doing this thing, and it's really strange that I know normally, you know, we live in a flat full of gamers, we vanish into our rooms and play games, and like I've refused to let myself eat breakfast or dinner or anything in front of my computer anymore.
Right.
I will watch TV and eat like a family. You know what I mean? It's like that thing, like, we're not good. We're going to eat around the table like a family. We're not going to sit in front of the TV. I've like a step removed from that, whereas I'm not going to sit at my computer. I'm going to go into the living room and watch the news or something.
Yeah.
Because it feels more socialized somehow. Like, yeah. It's weird. Like, the ways you trick yourself into believing that you're
getting a social fix.
I think mine, yeah, like there's so much media that you can consume, and like so many games that I can play, or so many things, like so many TV series that are good that I could watch, and I found myself now I can't stick with anything for very long.
Yeah,
and my attention span is getting slowly eroded. I think it's Owen's influence as well, because he's zero attention span.
Yeah.
But it's like I whenever I have a film now, and I have a film that I want to watch, I sit there in front of it for 20 minutes going, oh, it's an hour and a half. I haven't got an hour and a half. I can go and do this and watch this at the same time. I can go and play a game and watch a TV show at the same time. So I go and do that and not really absorb either. Hmm. In the same time, I could just be watching the film and actually absorb. And even when I get restless, I get my phone out as well while I'm on stuff, alt-tabbing to, you know, Reddit or something, checking my phone on Twitter. It's just, I'm aware that it's bad. And I'm not actually absorbing
anything. It's a kind of mental malaise, isn't it? It's a form of just so many stimuli and cramming it in there that it's just emptiness, really.
It's the reason I try and like regiment my life in certain ways, to basically try and control getting stuck in that kind of weird, unsatisfying malaise where you just do little bits of random things.
It reminds me of the episode of The Simpsons where they're talking about Mr. Burns's diseases and how he's got so many diseases trying to get into his body, they all get stuck in the door. You don't actually get any of them in instead.
Like, there's a thing we find definitely, I think, when you live with people who all have this sort of way of approaching life and entertainment, where your life basically defined by the amount of entertainment you consume. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's our jobs and our hobbies and our social lives and pretty much most of it, that sometimes you'll be in like a proactive mood where you want to kind of do things, like, who wants to watch a film or start a new TV series or play a game or something? And if everyone is out of sync, it just doesn't fucking work. Because it's like, no, because that sounds like an hour and a half.
Yeah.
You know, like you say, like, it's an hour and a half of my time. And then you're going to spend that time refreshing Twitter.
Yeah. Or, like, or sifting in and out of some terrible game, yeah.
It's weird. Like, this is probably why they sent people off to the army.
Probably.
Yeah.
Gives us some that, sense of that direction.
Fix it, yeah.
Anyway. Cow juice. Definitely. I don't think it's his real name.
Could not giggle.
It's just milk.
Well, is it?
Yeah, it makes it worse. It depends which
has anybody
bit,
tested it?
Which bit you come out of.
Do you think the new XCOM will get a sequel? If so, what would you want as its theme? Hopefully. It's not.
I hope so, yeah.
It's done surprisingly well. I think a game like that has to prove itself more than another type of game would have to in order to justify a sequel. But I think it has. Probably.
The things I want could be done as add-on packs.
Yeah, definitely.
I want new environments. I want new weapons. I want new
armor.
I want new potential skills. I like new aliens.
We want a bit of feature creep.
Yeah. New stuff, actually.
Yeah, contrary to everything
else. Get a bit of feature creep in that thing. No, because every game has its arc, right? You get the first pure one, and then the second perfect one, and then the third floppy one.
Is the more customization for the... Like, anything that lets me customize my soldiers even more.
Yeah.
Make them even more characters, bigger characters.
Definitely, yeah.
With which to tell my weird internal stories and play.
That'd be good. As a turn-based strategy game, like, because obviously the genre is a bit... limited in terms of but there is only so far you can go. I mean, limited in a different way of saying it. You can't really go too much further with it. I couldn't think of a sequel that would have, we'd definitely do this time. But there are a lot of things that I love that game, and I will play it more if there is more of it, because I was very happy with it the first time around.
The Ninth Life asks, which game have you thoroughly enjoyed in the past, yet make no intention of ever returning to ever again? Love from Neil.
Aww.
Thanks, Neil.
Cheers, Neil.
Love you too.
Aww.
Basically every single player shooter, really.
Yeah, Darkness 2, for example.
Yeah.
Like, that's a really cool game, actually.
They're like safe uninstalls in my brain.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Done with that. Wash your hands. Bioshock, I never play again.
Yeah, probably won't. I mean, I guess there are plenty of games that just have sort of, I feel I consider done. Like, as much as I rate it as one of my favorite RPGs ever, I'm never going to play Dragon Age Origins again.
Mm.
Because
yeah, so much time.
It's huge. And I've played every single piece of DLC with one character, and I've got this perfect save with one guy that I've taken through that entire story, so I never have to play it again.
Yeah, I'll probably realistically never play through Mass Effect series again. I love it. I love the entire arc. But my Shepard is now... I kind of feel like I'm betraying my canon if I play it with someone else. Like, that's not how it happened. I can't do that. And it's also partly that and partly the fact it's 90 hours worth of game if exactly. I was to go back through it. I rarely go back and play anything else, to be honest, like, again. There are a few games that I've had to sign off deliberately for my own sanity. Mm. It was like Red Dead Redemption where I started, got 10 hours in and just went... Well, not even 10, like 3 or 4 hours in. I was like, this is too big. It's the problem with I couldn't concentrate on it. And then I keep looking at it on the shelf of playing at 360 and just going, so much more I can do with my life that isn't herding cattle to get to the point where I get to Mexico and everyone tells me that's great, but maybe I'll go back, but I have no real intention to. I feel like I'm doing it out of,
you just
not
can't
desire.
Play. I mean, there is a risk when, and this may hopefully won't sound too gift horse mouthy, like Graham's moaning about having a Steam account kid
or podcast
episodes ago. But like there is a risk when your job is writing about games all day that you only ever play games with an analytical mindset.
Yeah.
And it's not that isn't fun, but it's a completely different way of, like, it's so, I mean, it plays to what we're saying about downtime games as well. There are a lot of times you just want to play a game once, have your thoughts on it.
Yeah.
And I would only go back to a lot of games if I needed to ratify something that I felt about a game. Like, if I realized that my opinion on Metro 2033 is wrong.
Yeah. Like, Darkness is a perfect example, because, like, I really enjoyed it. I think it's really, probably underrated.
Yeah.
I thought the first one was fantastic as well, but, like, really well-crafted linear shooter with, like, interesting story elements and a narrative that pulls you along. There's no any kind of that. Like,
just the right length as well.
Yeah.
It's about 6 or 7 hours.
It fits into a weekend quite neatly. Isn't overpriced, doesn't try and intrude too much on your time, doesn't, like, do too much with it. Mm. And I played that, I finished it, I enjoyed it, and I'll never play it again.
Yeah.
I recommend people buy it for a tenner, but
definitely,
I'll never
yeah.
play it again.
Mm. Yeah. So, yeah, an interesting other topic there about sort of value related to what we were talking about earlier, about feature creep.
Mm.
Like,
yeah.
You know, there's no way you could buy Assassin's Creed, say you bought it on console for 40 quid, there's no way you could buy Assassin's Creed 3 and not feel like you got a huge amount of stuff.
That's definitely true.
Like, even if, I mean, we, something about our perspective, which is very true, is we tend to appreciate well-crafted smaller things, partly because of the amount of time we have and everything else. If a game, and I think it's good design practice anyway, that I would rather games be massive and every single thing they actually do is fucking brilliant. That's ideal, but that doesn't tend to happen.
It's a modern thing. Ubisoft particularly, their games at the moment are very, let's just put over, I wonder if it's taken over MMOs, because MMO problems for a lot of it, and Guild Wars' success was the fact it didn't necessarily demand you spend your life playing it, because you didn't have to. You don't have to be playing Guild Wars all the time, because they don't need your subscription. Like, MMO... The old public is massive because it's massive, but also it's massive because it needs you to walk everywhere, and you only get sprint at a certain level, and then after that and it's the only reason these things are there is to make you walk longer, and that it seems like they're bringing a bit of that into other games. So you buy Assassin's Creed because that is your Christmas game, and you're not going to buy Call of Duty. Instead, you're going to buy Assassin's Creed.
Yeah. There's another thing as well where I was writing about this recently. This idea that developers want you engaged with their game for longer than before, and like this model, this kind of cinema blockbuster release model where a thing comes out and it has a good weekend and that denotes its success or failure, just can't work when there's so much investment going in. And people want this continued engagement with microtransactions that will actually increase the shelf life of the game and also its profitability. So I think we'll see more and more. Most major releases will have microtransactions, I think, as well as a full-priced boxed copy.
People define themselves by like the one series. And you look on YouTube for people who, you know, will only play... You know, a series of games,
and that
I assume is probably telling developers as well that actually we have, you know, it's never been easier to get to a shit ton of fanboys. Like you can talk to everyone that knows Desmond's birth city and blood type and everything like that, because people do get really into it, and there is this whole world around it. And then when you've
the Black Hills and the Carolinas, I think.
Oh Jesus Christ! So yeah, people like Chris who know anything about this, and
just a massive repository of useless information.
Yeah, there are like people who just play FM and nothing else, or people play WoW and nothing else. And,
so, it's never been easier to find these polarized communities. And then when they're going, hey, we want this, hey, like BioWare stuff, like we need this, we need this. Then developers are going, well, I guess we then have to make our game, like, it can't just be a like fire and forget kind of game. You have to have it lasting for the entire.
I mean, I think as well, on the uncynical side of that, I appreciate developers hopefully feeling a responsibility to provide a lot of value for what is an expensive entertainment product compared to everything else. However, I would rather games be £10 to £15 and be significantly shorter, so
yeah,
that more of them
would be better.
Like, you know, basically the thing is, games are too expensive, in my opinion. Like £30-40 is kind of ridiculous,
and it's such a monstrous investment from if you're actually, you know, commissioning that thing, if you're actually putting that, getting those big wheels into motion to make it.
Like, imagine if Assassin's Creed 3 was £15 when it was just the assassination missions.
Mm. You're basically describing indie game, so
partly, yeah, but plenty of games do well at that model, regardless. And you know, free to play is extreme the other direction. Mm. But I was talking about, like, you know, just getting those sort of 10-hour Call of Duty campaigns for a tenner.
The things I like, 30 Flights of Loving is what, 10 minutes?
13 minutes long, I think.
13 minutes long, and, you know, I'd pay like £3 for that, probably.
Yeah.
And but that's just wonderful and beautiful little thing that, you know, just getting used, if anything.
But £3 is below the threshold of things you'll take a punt on, right? Like, it's, like, I mean, going to the cinema is too expensive, right? Like, especially in Bath. But
it is in Bath,
yeah. Yeah, and sometimes it's better, but, like, here it's, like, £12 if you want to see a film.
Yeah. Well, that's Birmingham, it's, like, £5.40 and then
£8 over at Cinema and Lay, so it's, you know, it is far too expensive what you get in cinema.
But even then, people are kind of willing to pay that much and going, even though they're not getting like hours and hours and hours and hours worth of stuff out of it. And for me, you know, £3, yeah, I mean, if someone said, I'm going to show you this amazing little show and it's going to take 15 minutes but it's cost you £3, yeah, of course, like, that sounds exciting and cool. It's like, that's the mindset that should inform games. I think it shouldn't be that every game has to be your game for Christmas and that's what you're going to play, but that's kind of still the mindset, and I don't think it helps.
I guess it's difficult when you know someone like Ubisoft or someone like Activision, where you see the big Christmas juggernaut rolling on, you have to get on it, or the bandwagon. Put your juggernaut on the bandwagon.
No, not the Christmas juggernaut. Flee the Christmas juggernaut. Santa, no.
Christmas juggernaut is actually immune to magic, which ruins Christmas. Only when he's doing Blade Fury, though.
Yeah.
Dota joke there.
Dig ourselves out of this one again.
Yeah. Tea Leaf asks, who is American, asks, what's the difference between, this is just us as educational service, what's the difference between being English and British, and what's the difference between Great Britain and the United Kingdom?
That's a question for Wikipedia, probably, rather.
Yeah, but we can answer it really quickly. England is a country in Britain, which is an island that includes Wales and Scotland as well. The United Kingdom.
And Northern Ireland.
No, because Britain doesn't include.
Oh, right, you said Britain.
Yeah, Britain. Yeah. Now I'm trying to explain the difference between Britain and United Kingdom.
Okay.
God, this should be easy. Right.
My family's from Northern Ireland.
Yes, and then the United Kingdom is all of the countries that are in Britain. So England, Wales, and Scotland, plus Northern Ireland, which is
the Channel Islands,
and the Channel Islands.
The Channel Islands are technically the most important part of the United Kingdom, because the Queen's name, her full title, is higher ranking in the Channel Islands than is in the other places. Which means then, technically, according to old law,
she's like more queen there.
She's a harder queen. She's a higher level queen. Like a high level queen in the Channel Islands, which means that technically they are the more important province of the places within the United Kingdom. So
that's interesting. Anyway, so there you go, Tea Leaf.
That's what she keeps her giant mate.
That's the difference.
Yeah.
So
got to store it somewhere.
Yeah. So yeah.
Can't keep it in Buckingham Palace.
So if you're born in any of the countries in Britain, you're both either English, Scottish, or Welsh, and British. But you're not. If you're born in Northern Ireland,
you can't be United Kingdomish.
Yeah, you can't be United Kingdomish, really. It's confusing, but there you go.
And Ireland.
In other deeply informative game-related questions, Dave P. asks, what colour are everyone's socks and pants, I assume he means underwear, today? Do they match?
Black and black.
Yeah, black and black here as well.
White and white.
As far as I know.
Well, there we go.
So we all match, and yeah. That's good. I'm going to skip a few questions. Actually, apologies if you sent them in. We're going to load this week in the interest of time, but I'm actually something really good, so I'm going to hold them back for a future podcast. But Jordan Pomagalski asks, what is your favourite game that no one else seems to like?
Oh, that's a difficult one, actually.
Guilty pleasure question.
Yeah. It's not even a guilty pleasure, because it's just like critical consensus being against the thing you love.
I really, really enjoyed Dead Island way more than pretty much everyone I've ever met. I think I like reviewed it over a really short period and like just absolutely loved the idea of it.
Yeah, and I remember playing with you, actually.
Chopping it up.
I think it had a lot of glitches that were causing problems.
It was super rough around the edges, but super crazy ambitious as well. Mm. And weirdly entertaining. I had really fun, really good fun in co-op with it.
I just realised that my one's painfully obvious. Dragon Age 2.
Yeah. What game do you like that no one else seems to be able to accept that you like?
No
one else seems to appreciate any part of in any respect.
I like that game.
I like it.
Yeah. One of the first conversations we ever had.
Yeah.
I said, I liked Dragon Age 2. Anyway.
I love Dragon Age 2. I think as a the political thing, particularly the right character writing.
Literally, politics. I can hear the pitchforks outside.
It's the sheep come by.
That's what it's going.
But yeah, people.
That's the thing you'll say before you get assassinated. Then, as you're dying, like, I don't actually like assassinations.
I'll never say that. It's the fact that you can't equip. I mean, people hate it obviously because you can't equip your companion's armor, which is.
Well, I mean, there's a repetitive environments and stuff. It has problems, but it's an extraordinarily well written game.
Yeah, I can understand why people don't like it, but it's not.
Yeah, the same wonderful characters. For the reasons that I play Dragon Age game, I thought it was very good. Anyway. Mine is probably going to be, I really can't think of anything. And I've said my guilty pleasure game before, which is Poker Night at the Inventory.
Oh, yeah.
I like poker.
I like poker.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like me liking poker, so that's not really like, you know, a game that I seem to like. In terms of games that have a kind of popular...
Do you like Far Cry 2?
Yeah, but that's, in game thinky circles, that tends to be a darling.
Quite like,
so, yeah. I mean... I still think Mass Effect 3 is one of the best games released this year, despite the kind of broad scorn that the gaming community, or at least the gaming community as expressed by parts of Reddit and Gaff and stuff like that.
Self-professed gamers
say, I still think it's one of the best games released this year in terms of scope and ambition.
Absolutely
and
fantastic.
Refined mechanics and writing.
It's the idea that like you get to the end of a meal and someone pops up and goes, ta-da, you have to pay the bill, or you know, here's a horrible bit at the end of the meal you have to deal with. It's like you still had an amazing meal.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah.
Like without even getting dragged into ending talk, because I do not think the ending is bad as everyone thinks it is. It's the one that frustrates me the most, I think, because it's become the one that you're not allowed to praise, basically.
Yeah,
because the internet has decided
you
it's
could,
bad.
No matter what that game did, it could not have been it could not have done what everybody wanted, and it would have had the same level of backlash. And like you say, it refines it perfectly. I think the writing in it is they finally nailed all the characters down.
Yeah, it's beautifully timed, so everyone gets a good moment, and like there's it doesn't have to kind of. Run step shot over characters people cared about, which I think Mass Effect 2 came guilty of sometimes, where it threw that up so much and tried to read
it. Liara's moody now. Why? Don't know. Bye.
Yeah, well, it's my own DLC. Bye.
It's the culmination of one of the most ambitious storytelling efforts in gaming history, basically.
And they almost smashed it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And to be honest, they do absolutely smash it.
The Tachanka stuff is fucking amazing.
The Jack stuff, the Quarian and the Geth stuff, like those big running storylines all conclude brilliantly.
Yeah.
The fact that the overarching story, which to be honest has only ever been an excuse to tie those other things together, doesn't conclude maybe satisfyingly as it could.
Well, so the story like that, it's like when you get, in my head, it was like when you get a whole shit ton of helium balloons and try and put a tarpaulin over them. Eventually, some part of it is going to float away and you have to try and pull it back down to get the whole overarching story
to do
something. It was always going to be like a giant space gun or something or other, or a space baby or a star child. It was always going to be some dumb sci-fi thing that they were going to have to pull out.
2001 had a
thing.
Space baby. I mean, it can't be.
Yeah, also, you know, I also love that ending.
Like, you know, Deus Ex remains one of the most beloved PC games of all time, and it has a fundamentally dumb and fundamentally similar form of ending.
One of three
like,
endings,
so is Human Revolution as well. The choose your ending.
I did quite like Human Revolution, the fact it just had...
That was ridiculous. Who built that room?
It's the same thing as the first game, where it just went, choose your ending. And it's almost like they got to the end of it and went, just nod back to the first game.
I don't want to rant about it. I have innumerable problems with the way that game has been popularly received. I think people have misunderstood what responses to your actions actually mean.
Are you talking about Mass Effect?
Mass Effect.
Yeah, because there are huge
verifications all the time. But also, it's also the misunderstanding of the idea that making a choice in a game is still meaningful. The act of choosing is still something you're doing as a player has meaning. Like the interesting thing about choices is not actually the consequences necessarily, it's the anxiety and all that leads into the decision you make.
I went back 35 hours a game because of a choice in that thing. And
we're not going to argue about that again.
That's a separate discussion
choices that backfire are brilliant though. I mean, choices that turn out a different way than you expect. For sensible reasons that are internally consistent with the game world that they've created. That's good story writing.
I want games to pull the rug out from under me sometimes. I want games to confront me, the player, and the character with things that I can't overcome, to make choices for me sometimes. Because obviously it's all about context. You know, there is, like, without going on about it too much, because we talked about it before, but I played the fourth and most recent part of The Walking Dead last night.
Oh, yeah.
Which ends spectacularly. They've done such a fucking good job. It's weird, actually. It's written by Gary Witter, who used to be the editor of PC Gaming US. And it just throws a curveball at you right at the end. Like, right at the end, it's a cliffhanger ending.
It's the penultimate one, isn't it?
It's the penultimate one. Cool. And it sets up the shape of where that's going. Yeah. And it's clever, and it's horrible, and you watch a character basically be gutted, like not literally, that does happen in that game, but like no, but like you know when someone is just severely shocked by a bit of news, like, and it's just, and but you the player are going through the same thing at the same time, and you don't have a choice to avoid the thing that is going to happen, and people will probably go, you're not getting the ice cream and birthday parties ending, but it's wonderfully executed because it's done very quietly and slowly, and then you realize this thing that's happened as people, and it's just like, it's so good, and like. And the reason that is because it made me feel powerless. And I want to be made powerless if that's what the game wants to affect. Mm. And that's why Mass Effect 3 is good, because it successfully makes you feel like you can't actually save everything all the time.
I think as well, like anyway, we've discussed this before about my insanity about wanting to... I mean, the one choice I did change in Mass Effect 3 was something that was so central to my vision of My Shepard that I felt I couldn't keep on playing with what had happened. But the greatest thing about Mass Effect 3, not to go into the semantics of what we think we should do in the games, is the fact that both of us, who had very different approaches to it, had a great time. Mm. And the fact that it gives us both the opportunity to feel the powerless and also feel power, like you had the ability to change your own destiny, is brilliant.
It's just, this is a good discussion for our, I guess, end of the year podcast and stuff when we're getting around to discussing that stuff.
Mm. But
it's just that knowledge. And again, it speaks to internet culture and stuff like that. It's just that knowledge that we can talk for hours, I think, probably in some detail about why we think Mass Effect 3 is great, and things it does really well, and explain the mechanics behind it. But when we do that on any kind of platform, inevitably in the comments there's this assumption that the game is shit.
Yeah,
there's ulterior just reasons why we're saying that. There isn't.
Yeah.
Like, no, we do genuinely just think it's one of the best games released this year.
Has it achieved more than I think I was expecting it to as well?
So thanks, Jordan, for triggering that.
Yeah, that was a good question.
That was fun.
That rant. I'm gonna finish off with a question from Adam Dawes, the reliably excellent internet man who asks us good, silly questions. And it was actually his question that triggered the thinking back to the start of this podcast. So I'm going to send a message back in time, which is, if you received a message through time from yourself about gaming 10 years in the future, what do you think it would contain?
Jesus, that is a tough question.
So what would you be telling you from the future about games?
It's your kids!
What?
Unpack.
it's a Back to the Future thing.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's hard. This guy asked really hard questions.
Mine would probably just be three words. Sorry.
Is that a word?
Yeah. I have tuberculosis. No.
You're dead rat on me.
No, they would be still no holodeck.
Yeah. Actually, whoa, that's true.
That's sad.
Another three words could be Apple is coming. Because they might... They are making waves into...
I'd send Queen has mech suit, get out.
Just picked it up from Jersey.
No, it's a very serious message, though, isn't it? That's what I'd want to hear, I think.
I would imagine that in that time...
She's heading for the Channel Islands, where she's most powerful.
We definitely won't be playing games on Windows anymore. I think we're doing something.
That's interesting, yes, maybe.
We'll have gone Linux, or we've done Valve something. I think I don't honestly think there's going to be any vast title... sea change. I think free-to-play experiment will go a long way. Kickstarter will go a long way. Free-to-play might become the norm, but I doubt it forever. I think we will still have a Call of Duty game, probably. I think it'll be right at the tail end of it, and it might be released on mobiles first. I think one of the major manufacturers will have dropped out the console race, if there is even a console race.
Yeah.
It's a long message I'm going to send to myself. It's not very conclusive either.
Yeah, I think...
Bet on Apple, though, basically, in the gaming market is what I think is going to be important.
If you want an image of the future... Imagine
an angry bird stomping on someone's face.
Oh, shit, you ruined that.
Sorry.
Oh, Rich, you asshole.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say imagine a Call of Duty on a human television forever.
Yeah. I think Call of Duty will die before Angry Birds does. I think mobile gaming will be bigger, and social gaming I think will probably fold in itself because it seems to be doing that already. Mm. But I think mobile gaming will go larger, but it won't get any cleverer.
Tom, are you going to change yours from Queen?
Nope. No, happy with my answer, Chris.
You need to know.
Absolutely.
All right.
If we knew that, realistically, we'd all be investors rather than journalists writing about what's already happened.
Yeah, a journalist's job to figure this stuff out.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, our job's to figure out what's already happened.
I guess,
what's happened in the future.
It's basically to try and figure out what on earth is going on.
Yeah.
Which basically brings...
Which is hard enough.
Yeah, exactly. Hard enough. Which is basically brings us neatly back to the start of this podcast and is therefore the end of the podcast. So... Cheerio.
Time's always been cyclical.
Time has it?
Probably.
That's a big thing to say.
Bye.
Drop that clanging. Oh.
Bye-bye, podcast people.
Goodbye.
Cheerio.